You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So, how I look at it is you have the secret societal system that's able, through different people, through different organizations, is able to affect change within different countries. And they play countries against each other. They do all kinds of things. Their end game is to rule the world through China, these secret societies.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Chris Milligan. Today's show, Skull and Bones, Secrecy and Our Republic. Chris Milligan is a publisher, writer, and musician. His father was in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, Military Intelligence, G2, and later in the CIA, rising to branch chief, head of intelligence analysis for East Asia. His father told him things he didn't understand in the late 1960s. These revelations led to over 40 years of research into the subject of CIA drugs, clandestine operations, and secret societies. His publishing house, Trine Day, brought Anthony Sutton's America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, to a wider audience. He started Trine Day in 2000 as a vehicle to get suppressed books into wider circulation. With no shortage of spiked materials, Trine Day has grown to over 100 volumes in print and has succeeded in achieving a wider distribution for suppressed works. He edited and is a contributing author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. Chris Milligan, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Bonnie.
In the preface to your anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, you write that, quote, this book started as research into trying to understand some things my dad told me. Who was your father? Could you take us through his history with intelligence?
Well, his name was Lloyd Milligan, and at the age of 18, he was an exchange student to the University of Shanghai. This was in 1936. He started working with the State Department then. The State Department asked him to gather anything that he could about the Japanese. He left Shanghai a week before the Japanese bombed it, went up to Vladivostok, went across the Trans-Siberian Railway through Moscow to Vienna, then went up to Berlin, and then finally ended up in 1937 at the World Council of Churches with the Dulles brothers. And then he went back to school, graduated in 1939. He was supposed to go to a school in Switzerland for study on international relations, but the war, World War II, had started, and he ended up, got as far as the basement of the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., where he was working under Archibald MacLeish, who was a member of the Order of Skull and Bones. While he was there, they gave him the Philippines desk, told him to become an expert on the Philippines. He was in William Donovan's, Wild Bill Donovan's first organization, COI, Coordinator of Information. Then he went from there to OSS. And then when he was in OSS, he got drafted in World War II, and OSS said, great, you're still going to be working for OSS, but we're going to put you into the military. We do not trust General MacArthur and one of his aides, Colonel Willoughby, and they wanted him to spy on them and also to gather anything that was printed within the Japanese-controlled Philippines at that time. The gentleman, my father, they put him on as the personal and private secretary to a Dr. Hayden. He had been in charge of the Philippines education system, the library system. The United States owned the Philippines. And then when the Japanese invaded the Philippines, Dr. Hayden was working with a bunch of the guerrillas. Dr. Hayden left the Pacific Theater to talk to Roosevelt, came back to the United States. He died when he was in the United States. They took my dad out of theater and then sent him back to the Philippines to pick up the paperwork that Dr. Hayden had. And then he went back to the Philippines and started working a lot with the guerrillas, worked with the guerrillas, went with them into Manila way before the American troops. He sequestered the Japanese puppet government's library and papers. He got sued by the Japanese government for that and got given a Legion of Merit by the American government for that. And when MacArthur finally arrived into the Philippines, into Manila, he found a bunch of his friends in jail because MacArthur had been raised in the Philippines. His father, Arthur MacArthur, was the first military governor that they sent over there during the Spanish-American War. And there's a very thin oligarchy in the Philippines, and so these were his, MacArthur's, friends that were in jail. And he didn't like that, and he said to get rid of my father. They moved my father then from the Philippines to being head of research and analysis for the invasion of Japan. And they had to get somebody in to replace him into the Philippines, and that person had to be both in OSS and in military intelligence, G2. And there was very few of those people around, and the person they got was a gentleman by the name of Edwin Lansdale. And he was very much an interesting person. My father started working with him in psychological warfare during World War II. Then my father got given a special aegis between VJ Day and his muster, and that was he was supposed to write a special report on the Japanese use of heroin and opium before and during World War II. Then he went back to D.C., went through a couple of alphas, and was in CIA when it began. His last overt job in CIA was branch chief, head of all of East Asia Analysis Office. Then in 1951, he went covert. They needed somebody. My dad was a rather liberal guy. He was from the West Coast. They needed somebody to go talk to Sukarno in Indonesia, and so they sent my dad and actually myself and my brother and sister and my mom as a family to go with him to Indonesia. And then he came back to the United States, and what he told me later on, as kids we were told he had a job as a advertising salesman for the Glen Falls Sun Echo around D.C., but actually what he was doing, he was helping to write the what's now known as the PDB, the President's Daily Briefing. He explained to me that he called it a newspaper that they helped write for the President and the generals every morning. And then in 1956, he was sent to the Far East. Again, he met with Lansdale in Vietnam, and he must have written a report because Lansdale was soon recalled. And then my dad ran into some interference, and he told me he left the agency soft in 57 and then left him hard in 59. In 1957, he got... all of a sudden he went from being a part-time speechwriter for a senator and other things to becoming a vice president of a college in Nashville. And then, like I say, he in 1959, he was asked to be president of the college. The president had quit. He said no and left and moved the whole family out to Oregon. And he later told me in 1969, when he took me into a room with a Dr. D.F. Fleming from Vanderbilt, that he had quit them in 59. That's one reason he was talking to me in 69, because he had signed a piece of paper, said he couldn't talk for 10 years. And I thought about it later, and it didn't make much difference, I thought, because nobody would believe what he had to say.
So your father was working for intelligence in some very big hot spots, Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia. You mentioned the rebels in the Philippines. Now, were you referring to Philippine rebels that were going up against the Japanese, or just
the Japanese? Yes. He was working with the guerrillas that were going against the Japanese. There's a book that he edited, written by Hernando Abaya, who was a major Philippine journalist. It's called Betrayal of the Philippines.
A friend of mine has told me, and I wanted to ask you about this, that with regard to Ed Lansdale's work in the Philippines, that somehow guerrilla groups in the Philippines were either infiltrated or directed or whatever, and then wiped out eventually. Like they were. Do you know anything about this?
Well, there was a quote unquote communist insurgency, the HUK, or I don't know how you pronounce it, HUKS. And Lansdale ran a campaign. It was mostly Psy War. It was mostly false battles, and where they would say there's a big to-do, and then he would take his guy, who he ended up getting elected as a president, Raymond Magusi, or I can't say his name either, would be the big hero. And it was mostly a false battle campaign, and they would do things such as to scare the people. They would kill a body and drain all the blood out and tell the people there was vampires and stuff like this.
Well, now, was this a campaign in order to turn the general population against the rebels, or was it to figure out who they were so they could be wiped out?
Yeah, a little bit of both, you know. A little bit of both, but the biggest thing was a stage show to get the guy that he wanted elected president.
Yes, okay. Now, you mentioned that you and your whole family went to Indonesia. Now, what was going on? Well, now, eventually, the head of Indonesia that your father was meeting with, he was overthrown, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, that was a very, very bloody and horrifying overthrow. What do you think your father's mission there was?
Well, Sukarno had just consolidated power and had just, you know, come up with the country of Indonesia. It had been owned by the Dutch. And this was after World War II, and the colonies were, you know, going away. And so, and he was a, you know, he was for the people and stuff like that. So they needed somebody liberal that he could talk to. And so they sent my dad to talk to him and help set up a relationship with Sukarno.
Right. And then Sukarno was overthrown by Suharto, right?
Yes. Yes. And see, we left in 52, right at the end of 52. And then my dad came back, and he had already, he just stayed covert. And what he told me was that's basically when he started to write what's now known as the PDB, right, be part of the group that wrote that. And because before then, he'd been branch chief head of all of East Asia Analysis Office.
Well, was he writing the presidential daily briefings from Indonesia?
No, no. We came back to the United States and lived in Fairfax. We were only in Indonesia for about 2 years.
I see. And then when was Sukarno overthrown by? I get these names mixed up. What is it?
Sukarno and Suharto, right?
When was he?
After the Sikh. Remember, Sukarno tried to do. He had the Bandung meeting, and they were going to have a third world line between, you know, you'd have the commies and the capitalists, and then you would have this third world, which was all the other powers trying to get together to be a thing. And then also there's the situation of the gold. And I strongly recommend people to read a book called Gold Warriors by Sterling Seagrave. He is the son of Thomas Seagrave, the Burma surgeon. He was raised in Southeast Asia. Most of his books were Book of the Month Club and New York Times bestsellers until he wrote Gold Warriors. He got so many death threats that he moved to France, and he had to publish it himself. There is a edition that has come out from Verso out of England, but it just... If you read it, I mean, your jaw just drops. And Lansdale's a big part of it. MacArthur's a big part of it. Nixon's a part of it. But you see, the Japanese had a thing called Operation Golden Lily that started in the 30s. And they would go through Korea and China, and they would go into every little village and big towns and say, give us your gold. And they stuck around for, you know, some of these places for almost 10 years. And so they would get the easy gold, and they, later on, and there was this huge amount of gold and precious gems that were stashed in Indonesia, Burma, and most of it in the Philippines. And Lansdale, 10 days after he arrived in the Philippines, ended up doing an interrogation on somebody that led him to this gold. And this gold's a big part. We gave a whole bunch of it back to China, and then there was a bunch of this gold that was used to finance CIA operations and other things.
So approximately how long was it after you and your family left Indonesia that Sukarno was overthrown?
Off the top of my head, I'm going to say about 10 years. Seems to me it was right around 1960, but I don't know.
Okay, well then it was a substantial amount of time as well.
It was a substantial amount of time.
Okay,
you know, my dad wasn't involved with that.
Right.
He became aware of the drug trade, and that was his big reason for leaving. He just would not stand for it. He wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Was this? Are you referring to Indonesia or Vietnam?
Vietnam.
I see.
Vietnam.
What was your when was your father in Vietnam, and what was he doing there? And you were there as well, right?
No. This was 1956. We were left at home and told that Father was going to be writing this book on the church in Southeast Asia, and we were taken to our grandparents' house in Oregon. And he met with Lansdale at a little town called Toi Ninh, Vietnam, the home of Cao Dao, which is a secret society. And it was how I found out. Well, I knew about the trip when I was a little kid, and then my dad died in 1990, and I was in the midst of doing a lot of heavy research on a subject I call CIA drugs. And one of the things I was trying to find out, because I'd been told that Chiang Mai, Thailand, which is the second largest city in Thailand and is basically a heroin city, there's a four-lane highway straight to the Golden Triangle, and all the big banks have branches there, that it had been a small little village in my lifetime, and it's now the second largest city, and I was trying to find out information. and I couldn't. And then I was having a hard time. And then after my dad died, I'm going through his papers, and I see in this 1956 trip, his itinerary, he'd been in Chiang Mai, Thailand. And I say, great, I can go speak with my mother about this. And so next time I see my mom, I visit home, I see, I ask her, I say, Mom, how big was Chiang Mai, Thailand? She says, oh, it wasn't very big. Probably the biggest thing in town is the church. I've got some pictures of it. So I'm reaching up right next to where she's sitting is her bookcase with her picture books in it. And I'm pulling down the picture book from that time. And she says, and that's when I stopped believing everything I read in the newspapers. And my mother was a very good CIA wife. I would ask her questions all the time, and she would say, I don't know anything. I don't know anything. And because my dad was very sick for the last 10 years of his life. I really couldn't talk to him much. She says, well, that's when I stopped believing everything I read in the newspapers. And I says, what do you mean? She says, well, they'd been in Vietnam, and they'd gone from there to Bangkok and then to Chiang Mai. And she said the big story in the Thai papers was about this big battle in Vietnam, right where they had been. She said there was no battle. We were having a picnic. And so I turned the picture page, a couple pages, and there's my dad talking to Lansdale in Vietnam. And then there's this beautiful picture of my mother, I ended up showing it to my siblings later on, and it became one of the main pictures of her memorial because she's just vivacious in it. And she's sitting there and her skirt's kind of twirling, and you can see sitting on the ground over there, there's Lansdale, and they're having a picnic. And there's these people with fatigues and those little Australian type ranger hats walking around, and I look at the caption that my mother had written down, and it says, out from Saigon with Colonel Lansdale and North Vietnamese military leaders. And so in doing my research, in 1955, okay, we took over Vietnam after Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Okay, in 1955, Lansdale, because the French intelligence and the Corsican Mafia were still running the Golden Triangle. And Lansdale asked them to leave, and they said, well, no. And so there was a shooting war, and this is Gerald Posner's, one of his first books talks about it. This was one of the very few shooting wars between Western intelligence agencies. And we went up there and took over the Golden Triangle. And so this is right after, so my dad gets there in 56, and also you can read about Lansdale going up into Vietnam and bringing down a whole bunch of people from North Vietnam. It was all Vietnam at that time. And, what my dad told me in 1969 with the professor from Vanderbilt, he opened up his mouth. The first words he said was, Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it. I'm thinking he's talking about the mafia. It's the only thing I could think of. And it's this is 1969. And then he tells me, and communism's all a sham. These same secret societies are behind it all. It's all a big game. And at that point in time, I think my dad's nuts. And I'm a teenager in this late 60s. I know more about drugs than he does. And then this little light bulb comes on in my head and says, oh, he's having the drug talk with me. He hadn't had the other one. I was married and had a six-month-old kid. So I start to straighten up, and I'm, getting ready to say yes, sir, and all this, and waiting for my dad to tell me to stop smoking pot. And he doesn't. He tells me all about his intelligence career. And then they start talking about how they're playing out a loose scenario in Vietnam. And then they start talking about psychological warfare and sway pieces. And it soon becomes apparent that I have no idea what they're talking about, okay? But so this meeting in 56 that my dad had with Lansdale, for my money, he was right on, because they took American boys and girls and sent them to hell for 1 year. And then those boys and girls, some of them got addicted to the heroin that was being proffered to them by anybody who was 12 years and up. And then what does a junkie do? A junkie sells junk. And you take these boys and girls that are come there from all across America and send some of them back as junkies, because what I've determined is, you know, and what my dad told me, too, he actually told me this before the meeting with the professor. He had told me one time, he says, they're out to opiate your whole generation. And this was the first time I'd ever heard the word opiate. I knew what it meant. And I remember telling him, I says, listen, I never see that stuff. I don't lie. I just smoke a little pot. And he came back at me and he says, well, I don't care. You're still making money for them. And the way he spat out them, I knew he didn't like them. And so it was, and also the other thing is right after that, my dad came back. Lansdale was recalled from Vietnam. So I figure my dad wrote a report, and it wasn't very good, and Lansdale then was recalled. And there are people who say Lansdale was in Dealey Plaza that day, and for my money, he was the scriptwriter of the Kennedy assassination.
Well, yes, there's a very famous picture taken in Dealey Plaza in the aftermath of the assassination of President Kennedy that clearly shows what Fletcher Prouty said is Ed Lansdale walking down the street. The view is from behind, but the characteristic twist of his hand identifies him. This, according to Fletcher Prouty, and of course it's one of the many pictures of the three tramps.
Right, right. And there was also a general who was very familiar with Lansdale that concurred with that. And, you know, where did Lansdale come from? I live out in Oregon, and there was happened to be the town I live in, Eugene. Outside Eugene, there was his nephew, Ed Lansdale's nephew, lived here for many years. And we used to get together and talk, and we figured that Ed was an advertising guy from San Francisco. And there was the possibility that he had been connected with some of the occult groups in San Francisco. And that was one way that he got involved. Because, again, I look at this through what my daddy told me and the secret societies. And for what my research has shown, at the end of the day, that's who the ruling bodies are, is through the secret societal network.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Well, there you have it. Publisher Chris Milligan talking about his father's intelligence career, beginning in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, Military Intelligence G2, and later in the CIA, rising to branch chief, head of intelligence analysis for East Asia. Some of his stations were in the Philippines, Japan, Vietnam, and Indonesia, locations of great upheaval in the 20th century. Most, if not all of it, orchestrated by the powerful, and so many of these powerful are members of secret societies. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, we are offering as a thank you gift for a donation of $100, tax deductible, of course, a copy of this 712-page anthology, Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. This volume is, of course, edited and published by Chris Milligan, whom you've just been listening to. You can support the Pacifica Network and KPFA Radio by making that $100 donation by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. 5732 and asking for a copy of this jam-packed anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, which includes contributions by Anthony Sutton, Howard Altman, Chris Milligan, Dr. Ralph Bunch, Anton Chaikin, Webster Tarpley, and many more. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org and click on the link to books. It's a great premium, but of course, the real premium is commercial-free radio, where you can hear content right on your radio, not available anywhere else on the dial. Please support Pacifica Radio Network, which is our country's last bastion of commercial-free community radio, with no corporate or foundation funding, except for Democracy Now!, of course. The Pacifica Radio Network provides commercial-free content for hundreds of community radio stations across the country. And I know a lot about that because the Pacifica Audio Port is where I post Guns and Butter, and I can see little stations across the country downloading those shows. So the Pacifica Network is so very important, not just for the five big stations that are part of Pacifica, but for the content that the Pacifica Radio Network provides to all of these smaller community radio stations and college stations. It's so very important for you to support Pacifica and KPFA. A tax-deductible $100 donation today will get you this extraordinary 712-page anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. Chris Milligan, the publisher and contributing author, told me that he edited this volume to act as a reference guide, and it is jam-packed with history. It's a huge book, and you can pick it up in any different chapter you like by any different author. It's got an incredible table of contents. Fleshing Out Skull and Bones features 42 chapters from a dozen-plus authors, plus many historical articles providing a wide array of viewpoints into this very secret organization whose members increasingly affect world events. Chapter titles include the September 11th attack, the War on Terror, and the Order of Skull and Bones. Geronimo's Bones by Howard Altman, that's a controversial subject. Actually, I think at one point, maybe even presently, I'm not sure, the descendants of Geronimo are suing Yale University. I don't know where that stands. Secrecy and Our Constitution, Whom Do They Serve? By Dr. Ralph Bunch. Prescott Bush, $1,500,000 and Auschwitz, by Tony Rogers. The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby. That's in this anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Also, The War of 82 by Daniel Hopsiger. Reflections on the Yale Succession by Steve Sewell. The Order of Skull and Bones and Illegal Finance, a study of the analytical framework of conspiracy theory. The House of Bush, Born in a Bank, The Hitler Project, Skull and Bones, The Racist Nightmare at Yale, by Webster Griffin Tarpley and Anton Chaikin. Everything You Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know, Black Market Bones, Prescott Bush, The Union Banking Corporation, and the story, The Tomb, Man, Magic, and Yale, etc., etc. Those articles by Chris Mulligan. This is an incredible anthology, over 700 pages, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Please give us a call. Please support KPFA. A $100 donation will get you this incredible book. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Thank you to those of you who donate today on Guns and Butter, and to those of you who have made a pledge in the past. by the way, Chauncey Holt's book, Self-Portrait of a Scoundrel, that's still available for a pledge of $75. You can find that online at kpfa.org. Both books are published by Chris Milligan. Chris Milligan publishes all these books that can't get published anywhere else. Books that can't find a publisher, which is becoming a bigger problem all the time. So please support Trine Day, Chris Milligan, Guns and Butter, KPFA, and the incredible Pacifica Radio Network. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Just go online and click on the link to books, and you can find Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. I'd like to get back in just a couple of minutes to some more audio from, I actually had a 90-minute interview with Chris Milligan, and we can't bring you all the audio today, but I've pulled out some clips to play. You will find out about, in this book, son of Skull and Bones co-founder Alfonso Taft, Bonesman William H. Taft is the only man to serve as both President and Chief Justice of the United States. Also, Chief Justice of the United States, Bonesman M.R. Waite, in 1886 declared in two sentences and with no debate that corporations have the rights of a person. That's all included in Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, and over 700-page anthology, incredible history included, for a $100 donation. Please give us a call right now, 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation, of course, will make you a member of KPFA for an entire year. And as I have said many times, if everyone who listened to the station pledged $25, we wouldn't even have to fundraise. But, of course, most people who listen don't pledge, so it's always up to those of you who do to keep the station going. And I would also like to encourage a few of you who haven't ever pledged to please pledge today. That would be a great help to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. $100 gets you Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. $25 makes you a member for a year. And, of course, online at kpfa.org. $100 Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm so happy to be on the air to support the Pacifica Radio Network, and I would like to play you a little bit more of the audio of my discussion with Chris Milligan. Erica, why don't we listen to that second track? What do you think?
What first piqued your interest in Skull and Bones at Yale University in particular? Now, obviously, there are a lot of secret societies, but you mainly focused on Skull and Bones. What piqued your interest in Skull and Bones?
Well, you know, my dad mentioned secret societies. He never mentioned Skull and Bones. And it was the thing I found the hardest to find any information about. And basically, during, was it 1988, the George Bush campaign, I came across Anthony Sutton's book, America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones. And that started to make some sense about what my dad had said, because, like I said, I had the hardest time getting my head around, and communism's all a sham, these same secret societies are behind it. And if you look at America's secret establishment, it goes into how they were financing communism and financing Russia and other things. So it started to make some sense. And then when I looked at the people that were in Skull and Bones, I says, yeah, these guys are the main group. Now, there is basically seven secret societies there at Yale, and there's Scroll and Key, Book and Snake. I find Book and Snake very, very interesting. When Skull and Bones was started, you had Yale College and you had Sheffield Scientific School, and you could only join Skull and Bones if you went to Yale College. And so the people at Sheffield Scientific School, about 20 years after Yale was founded Book and Snake. And you have Bob Woodard's a member of Book and Snake. Brady's a member. Nick Brady, the Treasury Secretary, is a member of Book and Snake. But when I looked at Skull and Bones, they were the most powerful, the oldest secret society.
The Order of Skull and Bones was founded how long ago as a chapter of a secret society based in Germany?
1832 is when it was formed as the Order of Skull and Bones. There are scholars, Masonic scholars, who trace it to Phi Beta Kappa. Phi Beta Kappa was first started at the College of William and Mary. Two offshoots went. One went to Yale and one went to Harvard. Then came along the Revolutionary War. College of William and Mary was shut down. Yale and Harvard kept going. We had our first big anti-Illuminati scare in the late 1790s. And then in the 1820s, we started to have an anti-Masonic movement grew up. And by the 1830s there, it became not very cool to be in a secret society. So first Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard became an open society, and then Phi Beta Kappa in 1832, a bunch of people that were in Phi Beta Kappa formed the Order of Skull and Bones, William Huntington Russell and Alonzo Taft. When you get to that core group, what you find is that they're all related. Skull and Bones is built around the Cabot family with a big, strong subset of the Whitney family.
In some of the parts of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones that you've written, you go into an analysis or an explication of these different familial groups within Skull and Bones. I mean, there were the Bundys, and apparently McGeorge Bundy, his brother and his father were Skull and Bones, and McGeorge Bundy was in many, many administrations, including President Kennedy's, and he was really undercover for the intelligence agencies, wasn't he?
Yeah, they were CIA also. And, yeah, McGeorge is an interesting guy. He helped cause the Bay of Pigs situation.
That's right. He contramanded, I just discovered, President Kennedy's order to support the Bay of Pigs, and the flights were called off by McGeorge Bundy and then blamed on President Kennedy, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the whole Bush family, they're in there. I mean, there's so many people that we're familiar with in powerful positions that come out of Skull and Bones. It's actually quite amazing in your book.
Well, and it continues. The Black Something group that, what's his name, Steve Swarthmore, he's Skull and Bones. They own Sears and Kmart now. Your Treasury Secretary Mnuchin is Skull and Bones.
I did an interview with Webster Griffin Tarpley on events leading up to World War I. According to Webster Tarpley, secret societies and fraternal lodges in many different European countries played major roles in alliances and events causing World War I. In your research, have you found that members of secret societies have wielded extraordinary power in causing conflagrations?
Oh yeah, yeah. They help cause them. They'll sell arms to both sides, and then you find them at the peace treaties too, helping make sure that there'll be another war.
Now, the book that your Hollywood colleague was trying to make a movie out of, or whatever he was trying to do. Which book that you published was that?
Well, Franklin Scandal was one. Another was Dr. Mary's Monkey. And another was A Terrible Mistake, the story of Frank Olson.
Yes. So several of the books that you have published, and by the way, of course, you publish books that can't get published anywhere else, but several of these books that you've published, people have attempted, I mean, real movie producers have attempted to produce movies, and they've been prevented, right?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I was in Beverly Hills at the Four Seasons talking with the people that owned the Terminator franchise. I mean, you know, and they had already had a contract. They were going to make a blockbuster movie, $120 million movie on the Bilderberg Group. And I met with them, and I says, well, you know, you might have some political problems. And they says, well, once our latest movie is out in the video game, we'll have so much money in our bucket, it won't make any difference. And they did announce in Madrid, where the author of the Bilderberg movie was, that they were going to make a $120 million blockbuster movie about the Bilderberg Group. And then in less than 6 weeks, that company was bankrupt and went out on the internet, and it says, gosh, we really don't know what happened. They still have their money.
Now, one of the big contributors to your book, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, of course, is Dr. Anthony C. Sutton. And I read some of his contributions to your anthology. In 1968, the Hoover Institute at Stanford University published Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development by Anthony Sutton. According to your book, Anthony Sutton's research and publications claimed that the majority of the Soviet Union's large industrial enterprises had been built with the United States' help or technical assistance. Now, you met Anthony Sutton, didn't you?
Yes.
His background is really very impressive. I couldn't believe it. I guess he was born in the UK. He had this incredible education, and he worked in all of these very heavy-duty industries, mining, steel, etc., and then went on for more education at UCLA, Stanford. Did you work much with him?
I had the great pleasure of meeting him and working with him the last couple years of his life, yes. And he was working at the Hoover Institute, and they asked him to write that book on the Western economics and the Soviet technology. And he had published the first two books. It's a series of three books. And when he got to the third volume, which was in the late 60s, they said, oh, well, no, we don't want to publish that one right now. And Anthony, you know, he was a, what do you call it, naturalized U.S. citizen. And, you know, to do that, you have to read your Constitution. And so he was very aware of the Constitution, and he didn't quite understand this. And so he kept talking to him. Then they said, well, Anthony, don't break your rice bowl. And he broke his rice bowl. He went ahead, and because they wouldn't allow him to publish the third part. And so he went around them and published it as National Suicide. Because basically what his research had shown was that the war material that the Russians were sending to the North Vietnamese, because the North Vietnamese were not backed by China, they were backed by Russia, so much so that China would not allow trains to go across China from Russia to Vietnam. And so he found that almost all the war material was made in conjunction with U.S. technology, sometimes even U.S. plants that were ordered through Italy that were set up in Russia to make the war material so that the North Vietnamese could fight us in the Vietnam War. And so that was his first revelation. And so he got fired from the Hoover Institute there at Stanford for doing that. And so then he started to write what are his Wall Street books. He wrote Wall Street and FDR, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and Wall Street and FDR and Hitler. And then after he had written those books, somebody called him up and says, hey, would you like a list of people in Skull and Bones? And he said, sure. And they sent him out to him. He had to return the thing in 24 hours. And so he copied it and put it in a box underneath his desk. And he told me, he says, after a while, he would sit there and he kicked this box. And he said, oh, yeah. And he looked into it and he says, oh, well, these are a bunch of the people that he'd been writing about. So he then started to write these little booklets about Skull and Bones, and he could find nobody to publish them here. So he found a publisher in Australia that would publish them. But then they started getting stolen off the docks. And at this point in time, there was no internet, and he had a newsletter. And some people on his newsletter said, what do you mean nobody will publish them? And this was a mom-and-pop print shop up in Montana, so they started publishing his books. And I had sent them letters to them, but I'd never heard back from them. And finally I started writing about Skull and Bones, and I started trying to get magazines, and nobody would touch it. And finally I found High Times, and High Times wrote an article, and then the internet came around. I put it up online, and Anthony just sent me an email one day, and we became friends.
Well, Anthony Sutton is a very important writer, a researcher, and our gift today, the anthology Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Society, includes a lot of the writings of Anthony Sutton, many of which I have read, and it's a fascinating, fascinating read. He knew a lot about technology, hands-on, working in heavy industries. And he could put the lie to the very popular claim in the United States that the Russians were ahead of us, that the Russians were a competitor, that they're going to get ahead of us. And this was all not true. As a matter of fact, you can read in Fleshing Out Skull and Bones that Henry Kissinger himself, over the very strenuous objections from the U.S. Department of Defense, transferred high-level military technology to the Soviet Union so that they could build their missiles. Very interesting, very little known. There is an awful lot in this 700-page anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. Our thank you gift today for a tax-deductible pledge of $100 to KPFA. Please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I, of course, am Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter you're listening to, that we come to you every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m., and I have two co-producers, Tony Rango and Yaro Mako, who has been with me from the very beginning. We're asking for your support for the content that we bring you every week on Guns and Butter, your support for KPFA, your support for publisher Chris Milligan. My gosh, he's got 100 titles in print, and these are books that can't get printed anywhere else. His publishing firm, Trine Day, is very much like Free Speech Radio Pacifica Network. 1-800-439-5732, $100 for this incredible anthology, really, fleshing out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Society, Secret Society. And, of course, there's a lot more in here than just about Skull and Bones. There's a whole history of the United States, history of secret societies. There's articles on all kinds of different subjects. It's a great, great thank you gift. I can't recommend it highly enough. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. If you want one of the books, either Fleshing Out Skull and Bones or Portrait of a Scoundrel by Chauncey Holt, just click on the link on the KPFA website to books, and they're all listed there, kpfa.org. I want to thank everyone who has been calling, who supports the Pacifica Network, who supports KPFA, who supports Guns and Butter. A $25 pledge makes you a member for a year. Those $25 pledges are very important to the station. 1-800-439-5732. Now, if you'll remember the presidential election in 2004, will it be Bonesman Bush or Bonesman Kerry in 2004? And I think everybody probably has seen that sort of very funny short clips of who was then the host of Meet the Press, confronting both George W. Bush, who was president at the time, and John Forbes Kerry about their involvement in Skull and Bones. And, of course, they wouldn't say anything. They said that it was a very big secret. I wanted to get that audio to play for you today, but I didn't have a chance to do it. Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. There are 100 photographs and illustrations in this book, rare reprints of Bones memorabilia, a complete list of known members sorted alphabetically and by class, and extensive biographical materials, the Deer Island Club Handbook, hard-to-find historical articles, and corporate records. There is a lot in this book. Our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter for a $100 tax-deductible pledge, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, with Anthony Sutton, Howard Altman, Chris Milligan, Dr. Ralph Bunch, Anton Chaikin, and Webster Griffin Tarpley, only some of the many authors that have contributed to this incredible book. $100 to support our radio station and to get this very incredible book. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732, securely online at kpfa.org. And I want to thank everyone who has called today, who has pledged in this entire fund drive, all three programs on Guns and Butter. 1-800-439-5732. It's really a very nice book. Lots of illustrations. It's a very interesting read. Of course, I haven't gotten nearly halfway through it. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I want to thank again everyone who has pledged, and I would like to encourage everyone who hasn't to maybe consider making a tax-deductible donation to KPFA at 1-800-439-5732. Fleshing Out Skull and Bones features 42 chapters from a dozen plus authors, plus many historical articles, providing a wide array of viewpoints into this very secret organization whose members increasingly affect world events. Boy, that is an understatement. I hope you've enjoyed hearing Chris Milligan talk about his father and all of the revelations that his father has made. I found it very, very interesting. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You can get a hold of me at Faulkner at gunsandbutter.org. please visit gunsandbutter.org, and you can listen to a lot of the past shows that are archived. I've got less than 1 minute to go, and I'm hoping to get maybe even two more of you on the phone to support KPFA.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. It's March 2018 as I speak. New World Notes is always a little out of sync with the world, so you won't be surprised to hear a talk by Martin Luther King just after Black History Month has ended, and 1 month before the 50th anniversary of King's death on April 4, 1968. We will hear one of King's lesser-known speeches, somewhat condensed. King spoke at Stanford University in California on April 14, 1967. That is just 10 days after King gave his great, powerful, and extremely ill-received speech, Beyond Vietnam, at Riverside Church in New York City. In both speeches, King goes beyond mere civil rights to stress the issues of economic inequality and also the tragedy of an out-of-control military-industrial congressional complex. The speech is titled The Other America. Here is Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
I'd like to use as a subject from which to speak the other America. There are literally two Americas. One America is beautiful, and in a sense, this America is overflowing with the milk of prosperity and the honey of opportunity. This America is the habitat of millions of people who have food and material necessities for their bodies, and culture and education for their minds. In this America, millions of people experience every day the opportunity of having life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in all of their dimensions. And in this America, millions of young people grow up in the sunlight of opportunity. But tragically and unfortunately, there is another America. And this other America has a daily ugliness about it that constantly transforms the buoyancy of hope into the fatigue of despair. In this America, millions of work-starved men walk the streets daily in search for jobs that do not exist. In this America, millions of people find themselves living in rat-infested, vermin-filled slums. In this America, people are poor by the millions, and they find themselves perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. Little children in this other America are forced to grow up with clouds of inferiority forming every day in their little mental sky. This other America, we see it as an arena of blasted hopes and shattered dreams. Many people of various backgrounds live in this other America. Some are Mexican-American, some are Puerto Ricans, some are Indians. Millions of them are Appalachian white, probably the largest group in this other America in proportion to its size in the population. Is the American Negro. The American Negro finds himself living in a triple ghetto, a ghetto of race, a ghetto of poverty, a ghetto of human misery. So what we are seeking to do in the civil rights movement is to deal with this problem of the two Americas. We are seeking to make America one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The struggle for civil rights, or the struggle to make these two Americas one America, is much more difficult today than it was 5 or 10 years ago. We struggled all across the South to get rid of legal, overt segregation. In a sense, this was a struggle for decency. We could not go to a lunch counter in so many instances and get a hamburger or a cup of coffee. We could not make use of public accommodations. We did not have the right to vote in so many areas of the South. And the struggle was to deal with these problems. And by the thousands, we protested these conditions. Many things were gained as a result of these years of struggle. In 1964, the Civil Rights Bill came into being. We were able to get a voting rights bill. Now, all of these things represented strides, but we must see that the struggle today is much more difficult. It's more difficult today because we are struggling now for genuine equality. And it's much easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to guarantee a livable income and a good, solid job. It's much easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee the right to live in sanitary, decent housing conditions. It is much easier to integrate a public park than it is to make genuine, quality, integrated education a reality. And so today we are struggling for something which says we demand genuine equality. And I'm convinced that many of the very people who supported us in the struggle in the South are not willing to go all the way now. And I came to see that so many people who supported morally and even financially what we were doing in Birmingham and Selma were really outraged against the extremist behavior of Bull Connor and Jim Clark toward Negroes, rather than believing in genuine equality for Negroes. This is what makes the struggle much more difficult. Negroes generally live in worse slums today than 20 or 25 years ago. In the North, schools are more segregated today than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court's decision on desegregation was rendered. Economically, the Negro is worse off today than he was 15 years ago. And so the unemployment rate among whites at one time was about the same as the unemployment rate among Negroes. But today the unemployment rate among Negroes is twice that of whites. And the average income of the Negro is today 50% less than whites. We see the fact that the Negro economically is facing a depression in his everyday life that is more staggering than the depression of the 30s. The unemployment rate of the nation as a whole is about 4%. Statistics would say from the Labor Department that among Negroes it's about 8.4%. But these are the persons who are in the labor market, who still go to employment agencies to seek jobs, and so they can be calculated. There are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who have given up. They've lost hope, and so they no longer go to look for a job. These persons who are called the discouraged persons would be 6 or 7% in the Negro community. And that means that unemployment among Negroes may well be 16%. And among Negro youth in some of our large urban areas, it goes to 30% and 40%. In the Negro community, that is a major, tragic, and staggering depression that we face in our everyday lives. Now, the other thing that we've got to come to see now that is that racism is still alive in American society and much more widespread than we realize. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of the superior and the inferior race, that one particular group is responsible for all of the progress, all of the insight, and the total flow of history. And the theory that another group or another race is totally depraved and innately inferior. Racism is evil because this ultimate logic is genocide. If one says that I'm not good enough to live next door to him, or to have a good, decent job, or to go to school with him merely because of my race, he is saying consciously or unconsciously that I do not deserve to exist. It is the affirmation that the very being of a people is inferior. That however unpleasant it is, we must honestly see and admit that racism is still deeply rooted all over America. What it is necessary to see is that there has never been a single solid, monistic, determined commitment on the part of the vast majority of white Americans, the whole question of civil rights and on the whole question of racial equality. It is said on the Statue of Liberty that America is a home of exile. But it doesn't take us long to realize that America has been the home of its white exiles from Europe. But it has not evinced the same kind of maternal care and concern for its black exiles from Africa. In 1863, the Negro was freed from the bondage of physical slavery. But at the same time, the nation refused to give him land to make that freedom meaningful. And at that same period, America was giving millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that America was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor that would make it possible to grow and develop, and refused to give that economic floor to its black peasants, so to speak, that it was freedom without bread to eat, freedom without land to cultivate. But it does not stop there. In 1875, the nation passed a civil rights bill and refused to enforce it. In 1964, the nation passed a weaker civil rights bill. And even to this day, that bill has not been totally enforced in all of its dimensions. The nation heralded a new day of concern for the poor, for the poverty-stricken, for the disadvantaged, and brought into being a poverty bill. But at the same time, it put such little money into the program that it was hardly and still remains hardly a good skirmish against poverty. And all of these things tell us that America has been backlashing on the whole question of basic constitutional and God-given rights for Negroes and other disadvantaged groups for more than 300 years. Persistence of widespread slums and of tragic conditions in schools and other areas of life. All of these things have brought about a great deal of despair, a great deal of disappointment and even bitterness in the Negro communities. And today all of our cities confront huge problems as a result of the continued existence of these conditions. Many in moments of anger engage in riots. And let me say, and I will always continue to say, that riots are socially destructive and self-defeating. I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their struggle for freedom and justice. Violence will only create more social problems than they will solve. But at the same time, it is as necessary for me to be as vigorous in condemning the conditions which cause persons to feel that they must engage in riotous activities as it is for me to condemn riots. That riots do not develop out of thin air. Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. A riot is the language of the unheard. America has failed to hear that the plight of the Negro poor has worsened over the last few years, failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met, and it has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. And if we are to bring America to the point that we have one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all, there are certain things that we must do. The job ahead must be massive and positive. We must develop massive action programs all over the United States of America. Somewhere we must come to see that social progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. I'm convinced that we still need strong civil rights legislation. And there's a bill before Congress right now to have a national federal open housing bill, federal law declaring discrimination in housing unconstitutional, and also a bill to make the administration of justice real all over our country. And so there is a need for a federal law dealing with the whole question of the administration of justice. There is a need for fair housing laws all over our country. And it is tragic indeed that Congress last year allowed this bill to die. And I can see no more dangerous trend in our country than the constant developing of predominantly Negro-central cities ringed by white suburbs. This is only inviting social disaster. And the only way this problem will be solved is by the nation taking a strong stand and by state governments taking a strong stand against housing segregation and against discrimination in all of these areas. Now, there's another thing that I'd like to mention as I talk about the Massive Action Program, and time will not permit me to go into specific programmatic action to any great degree. But it must be realized now that the Negro cannot solve the problem by himself. There again, there are those who always say to Negroes, why don't you do something for yourself? Why don't you lift yourselves by your own bootstraps? Certainly, there are many things that we must do for ourselves and that only we can do for ourselves. Certainly, we must develop within a sense of dignity and self-respect that nobody else can give us. A sense of not being ashamed of our heritage, not being ashamed of our color. It was wrong and tragic that the Negro ever allowed himself to be ashamed of the fact that he was black, or ashamed of the fact that his ancestral home was Africa. And so there's a great deal that the Negro can do to develop self-respect. There's a great deal that the Negro must do and can do to amass political and economic power within his own community and by using his own resources. And so we must do certain things for ourselves, but this must not negate the fact that the Negro cannot solve the problem himself. A man was on the plane with me some weeks ago, and he came and talked with me, and he said, the problem, Dr. King, that I see with what you all are doing is that every time I see you and other Negroes, you are protesting, and you aren't doing anything for yourself. And he went on to tell me that he was very poor at one time, and he was able to make it by doing something for himself. Why don't you teach your people, he said, lift themselves by their own bootstraps. And then he went on to say other groups face disadvantages, the Irish, the Italians, and he went down the line. And I said to him that it does not help the Negro, it only deepens his frustration for unfeeling and sensitive people to say to him that other ethnic groups who migrated or were immigrants to this country just 100 years ago or so have gotten beyond him, and he came here some 344 years ago. And I went on to remind him that the Negro came to this country involuntarily in chains, while others came voluntarily. I went on to remind him that no other racial group has been a slave on American soil. I went on to remind him that the other problem that we have faced over the years is that the society placed a stigma on the color of the Negro, on the color of his skin, because he was black. Doors were closed to him that were not closed to other groups. And I finally said to him that it's a nice thing to say to people that you ought to lift yourself by your own bootstraps, but it is a cruel jest to say to a bootless man that he ought to lift himself by his own bootstraps. And the fact is that millions of Negroes, as a result of centuries of denial and neglect, have been left bootless, and they find themselves impoverished aliens in this affluent society. And that is a great deal that the society can and must do if the Negro is to gain the economic security that he needs. Now, one of the answers, it seems to me, is a guaranteed annual income, a guaranteed minimum income for all people and for all families of our country. It seems to me that the civil rights movement must now begin to organize for the guaranteed annual income, begin to organize people all over our country and mobilize forces so that we can bring to the attention of our nation this need and this something which I believe will go a long, long way toward dealing with the Negro's economic problem and the economic problem with many other poor people confronting our nation. Now, I said I wasn't going to talk about Vietnam, but I can't make a speech without mentioning some of the problems that we face there. Because I think this war has diverted attention from civil rights, it has strengthened the forces of reaction in our country and has brought to the forefront the military-industrial complex that even President Eisenhower warned us against at one time. And above all, it is destroying human lives, destroying the lives of thousands of the young, promising men of our nation. Destroying the lives of little boys and little girls in Vietnam. But one of the greatest things that this war is doing to us in civil rights is that it is allowing the great society to be shot down on the battlefields of Vietnam every day. We can end poverty in the United States. Our nation has the resources to do it. We have the resources. The question is whether our nation has the will, and I submit that if we can spend $35 billion a year to fight an ill-considered war in Vietnam and $20 billion to put a man on the moon, our nation can spend billions of dollars to put God's children on their own 2 feet right here on earth. It is necessary for us to realize more than ever before that the destinies of the Negro and the white man are tied together. The Negro needs the white man to save him from his fear. The white man needs the Negro to save him from his guilt. We are tied together in so many ways: our language, our music, our cultural patterns, our material prosperity, and even our food, an amalgam of black and white, and so there can be no separate black path to power and fulfillment that does not intersect white roots. There can be no separate white path to power and fulfillment short of social disaster that does not recognize the need of sharing that power with black aspirations for freedom and justice. Integration must be seen also in political terms, where there is shared power and where black men and white men share power together to build a new and a great nation. In a real sense, we all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. And so we all in the same situation. The salvation of the Negro will mean the salvation of the white man and the destruction of the life and of the ongoing progress of the Negro will be the destruction of the ongoing progress of the nation. We have difficult days ahead, but I haven't despaired, that I still have faith in the future, and I still believe that these problems can be solved. And so I will not join anyone who will say that we still can't develop a coalition of conscience. But I am still convinced that there are still many white persons of goodwill, and I'm happy to say that I see them every day in the student generation, who cherish democratic principles and justice above principle, and who will stick with the cause of justice and the cause of civil rights and the cause of peace throughout the days ahead. And so I refuse to despair. I think we are going to achieve our freedom, because however much America strays away from the ideals of justice, the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up in the destiny of America. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king. They built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and oppressive conditions. And yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continue to grow and develop. And I say that if the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face, including the so-called white backlash, will surely fail. We're going to win our freedom, because both the sacred heritage of our nation and the eternal will of the Almighty God are embodied in our echoing demands. We shall overcome because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth, crest, earth will rise again. We shall overcome because James Russell Lowell is right. Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up the day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and live together as brothers and sisters all over this great nation. That will be a great day. That will be a great tomorrow. In the words of the scripture, to speak symbolically, that will be the day when the morning stars will sing together and the sons of God will shout for joy. Thank you.
Martin Luther King's little-known but very good speech, The Other America, delivered April 14, 1967. Thanks to the old radio program DC-37 Radio for the skillfully condensed audio. And thank you for listening to our radio show, New World Notes. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Peace.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear a replay of Michael Parenti's speech given in May of 2010 at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California. He's talking about conspiracies. Michael Parenti is an internationally known, award-winning author and lecturer. He is one of the nation's leading progressive political analysts. His highly informative and entertaining books and talks have reached a wide range of audiences in North America and abroad. And three of his most recent books that he's written are God and His Demons, Contrary Notions, A Michael Parenti Reader, and The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And here he is speaking at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz on May 15th, 2010.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. I'm actually going to give a talk about deep ideology and conspiracy is really what I'm going to be talking about. And there's another talk I gave about a conspiracy. They just rediscovered it. It had been lost for some years, and they found the tape of it. Some student had actually taped it. It's not such bad shape, and it's available on TUC Radio, and that's called Conspiracy and Class Power. And that talk is probably more coherent and intelligent than this one will be because I was younger and more capable then. It's about 12 years old or so. I just heard it the other night. I said, hey, whoa, that's pretty good. And I thought I'd try to smuggle it in here. But, you know, it's better to really think anew and think about some other things again. But what do I mean by deep ideology? Well, I mean I want to try and fit it into the theme of this conference. But it is questionable because ideology is usually something that is out there. It's vigorously propagated. You know, you talk of the conservative ideology has talked about the free market. They talked about how government can't solve the problem. Government is the problem. We're overregulated. We're overtaxed. There's a downward distribution to the less worthy. And now money is wasted by government bureaucrats and the like. But behind this explicit ideological cell, I just gave you a sketch of what the right-wing dicta are on that. Behind that explicit ideological cell is an implicit ideological goal and rationale. A rationale that's really around very real interests. In 1978, I came across a quote by somebody from the Business Council. His name wasn't given, but he was saying things like, what's going on? The income gap between the highest and lowest is more narrow than it's ever been. Human services are increasing. If we will end up as a social democracy if we don't watch it, he said. Now, I found that very fascinating because I think there's only about 600 people in all of America who know what the hell social democracy means or even use the term. I mean, the term is simply not used in America, and that's a victory right there. The ability to keep certain words out of political discourse, like social democracy, is a very real right-wing victory. The ability to inject certain words like conspiracy theory, which puts a closure on any kind of thinking about something, that also is a tremendous victory. So this struggle, this battle over words is something to be taken very seriously. And if anybody asks me tomorrow on that panel, what will you do? I'll say struggle and battle over words. This was in 1978. 78, when this guy from the Business Council made that statement that we're heading for social democracy, what he meant is we're going to become another Denmark or Sweden or Norway, where people will have health care, where the standard of living is going to be very good and high, where there's going to be a real pressure on the super rich, where CEOs will not be able to make hundreds of millions of dollars every year. They're going to have to get along on just a few million a year. You know, how the hell can a guy like that live on a few million a year? So they don't want that. And 78 was a very significant year because that Business Council delivered the word to President Jimmy Carter. And we got Reaganism, and we got Reagan 2 years before Reagan. He didn't come into office till January 81. And in 78, end of 78, Carter was acting like Reagan. He started cutting back on human services. He called for an increase in the military budget. He was moving in a rightward direction. But Carter couldn't really do the thing that they wanted, which was a massive rollback. Carter was still beholden to the labor unions, to black voters, to progressives, liberals, and those people. And so they went with Reagan. Now, fast forward 30 years. You have had in that 30 years an ideological war that these guys have waged. They understand something that the liberals still don't understand. They understand something in the Republican Party that the Democrats still haven't been able to grasp, because the Democrats are too busy saying, we don't disagree that much. We really can work together. We can be bipartisan. They understand that ideas count, that ideology counts, that the words you use count, that those words control those ideas, and those ideas control those people. And they have been hammering home for those 30 years. So you go 30 years forward to the year 2008, and David Frum, GOP strategist, quote, the core task that the Republican Party has had was to stop and reverse to some degree the drift of democratic countries after the Second World War towards social democracy. And that is what we did in the U.S. We stopped the drift toward, and there's those two words that jumped right back up out of the page at me. It was in the New Yorker magazine. Social democracy. We got to stop the drift towards social democracy. These guys know about social democracy, and they know they have a conscious agenda to prevent it from happening. And they know that their opponents aren't even paying attention to this. The average Democratic politician, from Pat Leahy to Schumer to the others, with the possible exception of Howard Dean, who does know how to organize nationally and is totally ignored by the Democratic National Council, the others are all worrying about getting reelected themselves and putting in their little plea and talking about this or that issue. Well, what was Frum saying? He was saying, we've won the battle. We have so rolled back the social democracy that we've run out of issues. Furthermore, we've moved successfully so far right, we've moved beyond our base. And he noticed in the 2006 election, what? The Republicans lost Congress. And where did they lose Congress? They lost it in the goddamn Republican suburbs that always voted for them. Those people started waking up. Those people were saying, hey, they've been jacking us up the kazoo for all these years, and it's getting a little too bad. What are we getting out of this? I think I'm going to go back and start voting Democratic again. And domestic issues showed, and the polls showed, that the general public was on the liberal side of most of these issues. They were for human services. They were for keeping and developing Social Security. They were for health care and education and environmental protections and taxing the super rich. But as I said, the liberals never really mobilized that, never really built a narrative and a deep ideology and a public ideology around those issues, because some of these liberals are too busy not being liberals and being conservatives. Oh, we got a president who's like that. He's happiest when he can say, I'm for nuclear power, and we're going to drill offshore because America's going to be self-sustaining. Remember, he talked about he was a drill baby drill without the baby, but there he was. Those 40 years or so, the conservatives not only fashioned a mainline ideology, they built a net of media commentators, publications, networks, as I said, I mean media networks, think tanks, professional and academic associations of their own, training centers that would channel and recruit and channel cadres of young conservative activists into law schools and from law schools into clerking for judgeships and the like, teachers, writers who promoted conservative ideas and policies. So there has been this structure of organizations that has orchestrated and propagated a mass line ideology that has been guided by a deep ideology, that is the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class. Sometimes it peeks through in the mass line ideology when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism and progressive income tax is equated, and inheritance tax on the rich is equated with confiscation and communist theft, you know. The right over the last 40 years or more has been really pushing this line. Now, what I'm saying here is that this is a conscious, intentionally disguised agenda by people who know what social democracy is and say to you explicitly in English, your mother tongue, they say, we want to destroy social democracy. We don't want that in this country or any country. So they've got this, and they mobilize broad constituencies on behalf of the interests of the few. And that's the point to remember. A book I wrote on this called Democracy for the Few, now just come out in its ninth edition. Don't buy it. It's horrible. They sell it as a textbook for $70, $80, despite protests of the author. That's not what the book was intended to be, a book only for royalty or oppressed students, you know. But for the few, you see, the very few at the top. And that's an idea that is at the heart of their raison d'être. That's an idea that they dare not utter to anybody. You'll never hear them saying that on the air. You'll never hear Glenn Beck or Rush Limbaugh saying, all of this is for the interests of the very super rich. Everything I do, everyone I serve is for that. Epauchi is what they were called in ancient Rome, in the late Republic. And the term used quite often by one of them who was a member of the Epauchi. I wrote a book called The Assassination of Julius Caesar and dealt with this. They were called the Optimati. They were the inner core of the Roman Senate. The Roman Senate had 500 members, but there were these 15, 20, 30 who really, really owned much of Rome. And epauchi was the term used by Cicero, who many people would consider one of them. He really wasn't. He didn't have the right blood, but he was their faithful servant and their faithful spokesperson. Pauci in Latin means few. He was saying the few. This is for the few, you know. And sometimes he would be a little sarcastic about it and all. So we don't say epauchi. We say the super rich, the less than one half of 1% who really own most of the wealth. Now, whenever you ascribe conscious intent and pursuit of self-interest at the top, you'll hear someone say, well, what are you, a conspiracy theorist? You can say farmers consciously organized to pursue their interests, and everybody will say, uh-huh, the farmers are organized. You can say machinists or auto workers are organizing, and everybody says, uh-huh, they're consciously organizing and pursuing, or school teachers or other people. But if you say that the people who own most of America and most of the world, if you say they consciously organize and pursue things to get what they want, then you hear people saying, oh, you have a conspiracy theory? You think they really do that? The alternative to a conspiracy theory is an innocence theory. That is, they do all this stuff, but they're not pursuing self-interest. They just do it, you know. The other alternative is a somnambulist theory. Somnambulism is the tendency to walk in your sleep. David Rockefeller gets up in the morning and he says, what am I going to do to advance my interests and protect my interests? No, that would be conspiratorial. Hey, well, that stuff happens, whatever. That's okay. Another alternative would be coincidence theory. It's just a coincidence that this happened. Or sometimes a variation of coincidence theory is uncanny theory. Then there's stupidity theory and incompetence theory. Don't laugh at that one. That's used all the time. I have had about a 20-year argument with my co-politicists on the left to stop calling Ronald Reagan stupid, to stop calling George Bush stupid. It's good for a joke or something, but that guy knew what he was doing, and he did it. He got rid of the inheritance tax for the super rich. He cut corporate taxes down to almost nothing. He doubled the military budget. He waged two major wars and got this country into war and left it that way. He deregulated, well, actually another creep before him named Bill Clinton deregulated the banking system and all that to create this disaster that we've been facing. These guys know what they're doing, and they know who they're doing it for. They're doing it for themselves. But they will actually even use, they'll even use this idea of incompetence theory to save their asses. When Reagan was on the line and brought before that court because of Iran-Contra, after Poindexter fell on the sword for him and said, oh, no, the president didn't know. Yeah, like they were going to do this whole scheme, these billions of dollars down to the Contras, conniving with Iran and all this. They're going to do this without telling the president, without clearing it with him. Cabinet-level people are going to just do this. Of course. And then Weinberger and all these others. It turns out Reagan knew all about it. Reagan was the guy who okayed it. And Reagan's defense was incompetence theory, saying, you know, I just really got to get a better grasp on what's going on here. I should be more hands-on. And everybody going, oh, Ronnie, what a dumb dodo. He didn't know. All right, he doesn't go to jail. All right. So then there's also stochastic theory. Stochasticism among intellectual academic circles, which is filled with people who have too much time on their hands, they make up words like stochasticism. It means everything happening by random. There's really no causality as such. So, you know, stuff just happens. So history is just these eventualities that just tumble down on top of each other like that. And stochasticism theory has a use. I mean, there are times when such things happen that you could have a very rational causality of people settling in a valley, let's say, because the land is fertile, the water is good and all that. And so you got one set of causalities, and then you have the mountain on the side, and that has a geological strata, and that has another set, and then one day the mountain comes down and crashes down and kills the people. The mountain didn't intend to kill the people. And that would be a stochastic happening where two eventualities quite accidentally collide and hit each other. So there is in history both causality and accident. We're not saying there aren't accidents at times, but is everything an accident when it comes from the top down? Well, the deep ideology that serves the interests of the owning corporate class sometimes peeks through in the mass line ideology when there are denunciations of socialism and when equating government regulations with totalitarianism. Oh, I already told you that. Let me go on. It's reached the point now on conspiracy where it has become one of those requisite genuflection renunciations hardened by convention. That is where you have to deny it. You have to disassociate yourself. You have to be saying something. Let me give you an analogy. It's very much like in the 1980s when you had the requisite genuflection was to make an anti-Soviet comment. I can think of leading progressive writers who could not criticize U.S. foreign policy without saying, and if we do that, we'll be as bad as the Soviets in Afghanistan. Every third paragraph or so, there had to be a sideswipe, and you had to flash a sign. And I would say to one or two of them, why don't you just wear a big sign saying, I am an anti-communist? That's fine. And then once you hold it up, we'll all agree. And you don't have to keep making these genuflections. I can remember a colleague of mine when I was back at a postdoctoral at Yale doing this, or at Yale, the guy is worried. I said, Bill, you know, you got tenure. You got to keep flashing your anti-communist, anti-Soviet card. He was talking about policy in Africa and this and that. And there were all sorts of other things we could say. So that kind of hardened genuflection, it's a concept that is demonized and it's needed. Let me give you an example. Walter Karp, and it hurts me to take Walter because he was a wonderful guy. He's dead now. He wrote a book called Indispensable Enemies, 1974. He writes as follows. When it can be established, and he's writing about conspiracy, when it can be established that a number of political acts work in concert to produce a certain result, the presumption is strong that the actors were aiming at the result in question. Yes, when it can be shown, in addition, that the actors have an interest in producing these results, the presumptions become a fair certainty. And then he says, no conspiracy theory is required. You see, he has to disassociate. He's making a very intelligent conspiracy analysis, but he's got to disassociate and he's got to genuflect himself by saying, I'm not making a conspiracy theory here. No conspiracy theory is required. That's right. No conspiracy theory. A conspiracy analysis is being made, and you just made it. I'll tell you more, he says, because it's really good. He says, on the other hand, those who make blanket condemnations of conspiracy theories base their own view on a far-fetched theory indeed, namely that whatever those in high office actually do, they are essentially men of goodwill. So you have those people who say there can't be such conspiracies because our leaders are people of goodwill. They have good intentions, and that's the way they are. I'll return to that point later. According to this school of special pleading, the king can do no wrong doctrine, suitably updated, it is entirely proper to praise an American president for skillfully engineering some desirable result. But to ascribe to him the same skillful engineering of an indefensible one is to fall victim to political paranoia and conspiratorial fetishism. I mean, that's not – Karp doesn't believe that. He's saying that's the way these people think, that when the president does something craftily and cleverly and succeeds and wins a victory, everybody says, oh, that was good political leadership. That's what that was. But if you say he would use craft and guile and skill to perpetrate unsavory ends like starting a war of aggression, then that's conspiracy theory that you're having. And there are these other two words. He mentioned one of the other two words. You see it in the press regularly. If they don't say you're suffering from conspiracy theory, they'll say you're being paranoiac or you're being cynical. The cynical view, that's the other term that's sometimes used. So what we're facing, and not only from mainstream media and conventional academics, but even from among some leading progressive writers, we're facing a knee-jerk resistance to ascribing intent or covert actions and such by dismissing such ascriptions as conspiracy theory. So the term conspiracy theory is used to dismiss, one, the idea of a conscious design by policymakers. Two, a hidden but knowing intent. Three, a secret plan. Four, a secret interest. The term conspiracy theory is applied in two dimensions. The first dimension focuses on specific actions and events: an assassination, an act of terrorism, a mysterious disappearance of giant skyscrapers, a dirty deal in business, which is an illegal one. Or the second ascription is to dismiss an entire class interest, an entire social and ideological agenda. Rulers do not rule from secret intent. Do you get the difference? I mean, one is about specific actions and the other is about the whole system and structure. This explains why somebody, say, like Noam Chomsky, who does very good and very valuable work, this is not to take away anything from him in other areas, but I've had differences with him over the JFK assassination. Noam Chomsky, Alexander Coburn, Chip Berlet, they denounce this conspiracy theory and they say if you're a radical, you don't go looking at these little hokey-pokey secret plots, most of them imagined, even a few might be real, so what? Because there's the larger, bigger picture you got to look at. He's surprised, and they are surprised to find out, that they themselves are thought of as conspiracy theorists. There are people who think Noam Chomsky is a conspiracy theorist because of that second use of the term, that is, using it to mean a whole class power systemic intent that's directed toward certain kinds of forces. Behind the left rejection of the concept of conspiracy theory in academic circles is this structuralist functionalist debate that's gone on. Many of you have not heard about this structuralist functionalist debate over the years. You have every reason to be grateful that you haven't It shows that you haven't been wasting your goddamn time on this issue. Well, the debate goes something like this. If you try to explain things through incidental or idiosyncratic analysis, this is very poor analysis, you know. If you try to say, well, the Spanish-American War happened because McKinley was all sort of scared and weak and Teddy Roosevelt was a real bombastic and these personalities of the actors and that brought the war on, or King Louis, who was it? King Louis says, no, it wouldn't be King Louis says, gave aid to the American revolutionaries because, I forget, somebody killed his pet cat and he got angry at the guy and so forth and somebody, you know, little incidentalist stories like this or personalities and such, that is a very limited and dubious analysis of trying to explain historical phenomena. That the more impersonal and the more systemic, then the more radical. And the more systemic, the less volitional. The broader is the scope when you have a systemic analysis, and the deeper is the depth of your analysis, it is assumed. But what they're assuming here, you see, is a conflict between structural factors and functional factors, volitional factors, where people are consciously acting as actors with conscious intent. Because, in fact, the structure plays itself out through volitional forces. You have to have volitional forces. The CIA is itself... Neither is the CIA structuralist or is it functionalist. Functionalist, in other words, functionalist is discarded. Conspiracy theory is discarded as a form of functionalism. And Michael Abbott and Noam Chomsky had an article on that in Z Magazine. They call themselves structuralists, that they have structural. And I had a contract on a book I was writing at the time, Against Empire, with, what was that, the publishing house in Maine, the Common Courage. He didn't want to go on with the project. I canceled it with him, and I switched it over to City Lights as my publisher. And he said on the phone, this was after I had written that thing on JFK assassination. He said, well, you're a functionalist, and I'm a structuralist. You know, and I had other words for what he was and what I was, sounding something like structuralist and functionalist. And I'm saying, what is wrong with these guys? They suffer from in academia, academics are never happier than when they can choose up sides and they can dichotomize an issue. Well, you're a structuralist, I'm a functionalist, or you're a something otherist, and I'm a thisist, and then they choose up and they start fighting, and they have a little. You're a behavioralist, and I'm a intentionalist. You're a this and this, and I'm a thatalist. That's when they're really happy. And, of course, most of the time, these things aren't mutually exclusive. These functions play out. The CIA, as I started to say, the CIA is a structured conspiracy operation. You know, you could say, is the CIA a systemic agency that's part of a whole overriding class interest that must mobilize power in a certain way and does these things and operates that way? Or is it a bunch of conspirators who are doing that? And there are those of us who say, why can't it be both? Doesn't A and B, don't A and B serve each other perfectly well? But as I say, if you're so busy choosing up sides to keep yourself busy, they have too much time on their hands. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. Did you get that down? That's a direct quote from Michael Parenti. Okay. I should have read it more slowly. I see some of you were fumbling for pens. Oh, you want me to read it again? All right. History plays out functionally within the confines of structural developments. I don't even know what that means, but that sounds like this.
You've just been listening to a speech by Michael Parenti at the Understanding Deep Politics Conference in Santa Cruz, California on May 15th, 2010. Tune in next week to hear the final part of that speech. You can also catch the video of the speech at the website understandingdeeppolitics.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Ash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Building Bridges features Oscar Lopez Rivera on U.S. colonialism after Hurricane Maria. Oscar Lopez Rivera has been called the Nelson Mandela of Puerto Rico. Indeed, like the South African legend, Rivera was imprisoned for his anti-colonial activism and spent decades in prison. But in January 2017, after serving 35 years of his 70-year sentence, President Barack Obama, as one of his last acts in office, commuted Rivera's sentence. In May 2017, Oscar Lopez Rivera was a free man.
It's a great honor to be here, particularly in my home turf of Brooklyn, with Oscar Lopez Rivera. While I'm delighted and thrilled and enthusiastic to see somebody of your conviction and just an intrepid politics towards liberation, I am similarly demoralized looking at Puerto Rico, which seems to be even more firmly in the grip of colonialism by virtue of really a perfect storm, and that is the decimation from Maria, which was in many ways ushered in through the reality of colonialism and the Fiscal Control Board PROMESA that has a stranglehold on the island. So how does one even begin at this period to organize and parse out the tasks towards a liberatory agenda for the island of Puerto Rico?
The most important element that we have to address in Puerto Rico are the most marginalized people, the working class, the poorest of the poorest community, because they have been the one most affected by the Hurricane Maria, but also by the decisions that have been made by the Fiscal Control Board, by FEMA, by the Army Corps of Engineers, by the government of Puerto Rico, that only does one thing, and that is to protect the interests of Washington, the interests of Wall Street. There's never been a main concern for the Puerto Rican people. But in this case, after Maria, the plight of the Puerto Rican people, especially the poorest of the poor, the working class, they're the ones who have suffered the most and continue suffering to this day. When the people have no roof over their heads, very little food or no food at all, when people have no water or a little bit of water, under those conditions, they need to be lifted. They need to be treated with dignity and respect. The saddest thing is that the ones who are the most vulnerable, the poorest of the poor, they are the ones who are viciously attacked. We are called, we're told, well, you're lazy, or you like dependence, you don't like to work, or you don't like to do things. But the facts are that Puerto Ricans are hardworking people. The best example that I can use is that right after Hurricane Maria attacked, it was the Puerto Rican people, the ones who did the cleaning, the ones who did the work, the ones who were there to do and help the community in as much and in as many ways as they could themselves. Then all of a sudden we have this imposition on Puerto Rico, the Fiscal Control Board. We have FEMA, we have the Army Corps of Engineers, and then we have a colonial administration that only serves the colonizer. Those are the things that we need to be able to eradicate, to overcome, and the things that we need to transcend. And hopefully that as we reach out to the poorest community, as we reach out to the marginalized community, and those communities begin to work for themselves, to do things for themselves, to feel that they are empowered to do in Puerto Rico what needs to be done, I think that that is the most and the best way moving to a liberatory mindset, a liberatory spirit, and one that we hope will produce the decolonization of Puerto Rico.
One of the things that is also on the horizon, it's actually begun, is the decimation of the workforce. Now, along with a massive migration out because of the devastation from the hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico, there is the privatization now of essential sectors. There's the closing scheduled of 300 schools. There are the teachers, no doubt, who will lose their jobs as schools are privatized, taking from their model. What happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, where we had that kind of disaster capitalism that moved to privatize things. There's the water, there's the electrical union. So there's potentially massive loss of public sector jobs. How do you see that playing in, or what's happening and going to be happening to those workers as part of the process of building a real movement to assume control from Governor Rossello and from the junta?
Once a person loses his or her job, the only avenue open to them is to migrate. So that is right now the only option because there are no jobs. And the little businesses that were affected by Maria, a lot of them have not been able to get started. I'll give you probably the best example. I was going to Rio Piedras, and the only way that they could operate their little businesses with the generators. You have a generator for 12 hours. It's a very expensive little apparatus. So if you are going to spend more money trying to maintain the little business open, if it's going to be costlier than profitable, most likely the owner will definitely close. You mentioned the 300 schools that have been proposed to be closed because the junta, the fiscal control board, has made the decision that those schools need to be closed because the only way that they can privatize the schools is by closing them. It's an open door for the private sector to move in there. The same thing with electricity. The electricity has a long history in Puerto Rico. That is sad because the best paid jobs in Puerto Rico were the ones with the electric company. And those workers fell asleep. They knew that when Donna Hugh arrived in Puerto Rico, that she had a plan, and that plan was to privatize. They knew this, yet they did not move. They're trying to move now, and I went to a meeting 4 days ago, and it was sad because they were just starting to come together to see if they can stop privatization. And when we start at such a disadvantage, it's going to be very hard to stop privatization of the electric company. We have all the vultures surrounding that because the companies will make a tremendous amount of money at the expense of Puerto Rico because for the alleged government of Puerto Rico, because it's not a government, it's just people who work to administer the colony, for it to spend $2 billion to fix the infrastructure. But those $2 billion are right now, those $2 billion come out of the pockets of the Puerto Rican people because it's part of the budget. Money that has been collected from the Puerto Rican people. Those $2 billion can be used for education. We don't have to close 300 schools. They closed 157 schools in August. And mostly all those teachers had to leave Puerto Rico. So that adds more and more to the brain drain that we suffer in Puerto Rico. And we've been suffering that for the last 18 years. So the future of Puerto Rico, and this is the plan, and I'm fairly certain that those who are behind this have already made good calculations. There's the gentrification in Puerto Rico. Building very expensive condominiums, those condominiums are not being for Puerto Ricans. The incentive for people who purchase those condominiums is like a 25-year non-taxes on those condominiums. If I were to buy a house tomorrow, I would be paying taxes on that building. So there's a difference. For me, it would be impossible to avoid paying the taxes. But yet a foreigner will have that advantage. Mm. So if I see gentrification, if I see this intensive campaign to privatize what is left of the public sector, because Puerto Rico privatized the airport, Puerto Rico privatized the telephone company, Puerto Rico privatized the tolls. And when we see how much of Puerto Rico has been privatized, it's scary. When the hospitals were privatized, They said all kinds of positive things. Today, the conditions, the medical problems in Puerto Rico are the most serious ever. The structure that was left behind is useless. So they privatized the hospitals, and now we have the consequences. Because when Maria happened, none of those hospitals were ready to face the conditions. No electricity. They didn't have the wherewithal to start any kind of energy. A lot of people had to leave Puerto Rico. A lot of thousands and thousands of Puerto Rico who were sick, who were in hospital, were brought to the United States. Many people died because the hospital could not provide the structure to deal with their conditions. When we look at those things and we see what has happened in Puerto Rico, there's got to be a plan similar to what happened in Hawaii. The native population was little by little became smaller and smaller. More people from the 48 states moved there. And all of a sudden, Hawaii was made into a state. One of the probabilities, one of the possible goals is to depopulate Puerto Rico, of Puerto Ricans. And if we see, we have over 5 million Puerto Ricans in the United States and probably less than 3 million in Puerto Rico right now. When we take the census in 2 years, we will see how much the reduction is. But I dare say that probably there are less than 3 million citizens of Puerto Rico living in Puerto Rico right now.
I'm also a legal aid lawyer, and one of the things that we are doing is we are processing Puerto Ricans who have come from the island here for various SNAP benefits and public assistance benefits. But the depopulation is really clear, and I would say that there's approximately 1 million people that have now filtered into New York. So along with the depopulation and your suggestion that Puerto Rico's development would be analogous to a kind of bedroom community for the mainland elite, given that kind of devastation, on one hand, you'd think the conditions are absolutely ripe for a revolutionary approach. On the other hand, similarly, is the devastation of a people and the decimation of a lot of the revolutionary groups that existed, from macheteros or people like yourself who spent commendably for your principles decades in the jail. So what is the organizing approach now? And do you have some sense that the moment can indeed be ripe for anti-colonialists, for independent ideas to take hold in the populace?
First of all, we're trying to create a movement to educate. For Puerto Ricans to have an appreciation of the potential that there is in Puerto Rico, because the potential is there. For example, if we look at the northern part of Puerto Rico, we have the Atlantic on the north, southern part we have the Caribbean. The water in Puerto Rico, an independent Puerto Rico, we have access to from 9 to 12 miles. And in that water, we can develop a fishing industry. We can use the water as a source of energy. We can use that water to promote ecotourism. And we can even use that water for alga. So we have, just with the water alone, we have one resource that will help us to create the economic base that we need. The other thing is, right now we have a lot of young people who are creating ecological agriculture, very small plots, but very effective. This is something that younger people are doing right now. We have also the potential of doing urban gardening, and we're promoting that. We're talking about solar energy, and we're planning, hopefully, that before the whole thing is privatized, that we can probably advance and do something with the solar energy. We have the human resource still to do the work, and that's the most important resource, to make Puerto Rico create a viable economy and to create a base. What we're doing right now is trying to educate the people, to learn, to see, to appreciate the potential that is there. One of the problems with colonized people is that they don't see the potential. They never see that they have the potential and the power within themselves to do things that are needed to be done in order for Puerto Rico to become an independent nation. One of the things, again, that I mentioned is that Puerto Ricans responded to the hurricane in a way that was very, very positive, very collective. We organized brigades that would go throughout Puerto Rico. We organized the medical brigades that would provide medical service. We had one brigade that did the dental service to poor communities, to marginalized communities. And the good thing is that in those communities where we have been working, people, the residents are talking about creating micro enterprises, small enterprises that they can control. The potential is there to make it viable. The things that we hear from the people, the conversations that we're having with the people, lead us to believe that we have the potential right now to decolonize Puerto Rico, to create the movement. It is difficult because independence in Puerto Rico has been so mistreated, so condemned, so criminalized, that it's very difficult for people to say, well, if I join an independence movement, I can be sent to prison. I could lose what I have. So there's that fear. So we have to make sure that the people understand that it's within them. Part of the job that we have to do is to go into the community, organize them, radicalize them. Because the power is in those communities. The power is in the people. We have to go with the people. One of the problems that independentistas have had in the past has been that we have moved more toward an elite and less to the poor, to the marginalized. We have paid less attention to the communities that are probably the largest, numerically the largest, and have maintained ourselves very close to the Puerto Ricans, the professionals, the Puerto Ricans who have a better education. Independentistas are mostly in that category. And what we need to do now is for us to go into the communities, to really, really radicalize those communities, to show them that within them, each individual has the power to do something to make Puerto Rico the nation that it has the potential of being. There is no doubt in my mind that if within Puerto Rico we have the wherewithal to make Puerto Rico an independent and a sovereign nation with the potential of being a very strong small nation.
One of the realities, of course, is that I would call it a kind of neo-fascist administration. Its standard bearer is Trump, but he is stand-in for General Kelly and the entire Republican apparatus, and I dare say, certainly on international issues, considerable part of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And indeed, the colonial, anti-colonial movement, which many of us turn to for inspiration and instruction, the time has passed. Mm-hmm. So how do you begin to rebuild an ideological sensitivity towards socialism, to cultivate an anti-capitalist sensitivity in the midst of what certainly appears to be the consolidation worldwide of capital? Your thoughts on that very, very complex thing of instilling a socialist ideology in the working class, in the peasant classes, and so on.
The best way to get people to understand the dynamics of socialism is by working together. If we have, for example, a fishing pond that is a cooperative, the whole community owns that, the whole community becomes self-sufficient with that, then that is one way of creating the example. Human beings usually respond to concrete examples. So the best way to educate is always to create concrete examples. People realizing that they have the power, if they come together and they work together, and it could be with schools, it could be with a factory, it could be as long as they begin to work together, equal benefits for everybody, equal opportunities for all of them, and they maintain that cohesiveness, I think that we will be on the way of creating the society that we really need. Problem with capitalism right now is probably more dangerous now than ever before. Especially in this country, they have been able to convince people that all the little gadgets that they buy, all of that is precious to them. And we can see thousands of people. Let's say that a telephone manufacturer makes a new telephone. They put it on the market, they advertise it, and we see millions of people moving to have access to a phone. We can see your Black Fridays. We can see how people, that gratification, that immediate gratification. In Puerto Rico, we see it. Lines of people shopping on credit, but that's immediate gratification. They have something. I've lived in this country for a long time, and I've seen how people begin to be more and more transforming themselves into commodities. Once the human being becomes a commodity,
Once the human beings commodify, then it's over. That is one of the things that really is happening here. Let's take education. I remember when education, you could have access, not to the best, a real, real good education, because you were not going to come out of college being a critical thinker, but it was a better education than they have now, and people were not indebted. From 1980 to 2012, the debt of those who went to the university was $3 trillion debt. That apparatus was created, the banking industry, the people who make the loans. The whole thing of deregulating the banks, the whole thing of making a corporation a citizen, the whole thing of globalization, the whole thing of making sure that the environment can get destroyed and those who destroy it don't have any responsibility. That has been happening since 1971. They made a decision. They said, well, the problem in the United States, within the United States, is an excess of democracy, and we have to terminate that. And soon after that, all the little gains that civil rights movement had made were nullified. Everything went more and more to the right. And all of a sudden, we have a very right-wing government. And, by the way, it's not that the people, because the people, it is that they created an infrastructure where enough states will come together, and if in 2020, if Donald Trump runs again, those states with the Electoral College will elect whoever they want. It could be one worse, probably worse than Trump. Because the infrastructure has been created. That infrastructure has been created through the process of globalization, through the process of privatization. Who invented the privatization of education? How can education be transformed into a commodity? They did, sold. Because that's the only way that you can get an education. That has happened here, and it's happening in Puerto Rico, and it's happening in different parts of the world. So the pattern has been created, and it works for them. It works for capital. It doesn't work for us. The only way that we can respond to that is getting deep into the communities, getting deep into the poorest of the poor, getting them to really see, because they don't have anything. They don't have that much to lose. They can say, listen, you know, this is what we have. We can do it. We can work at it. We can create a system that is completely different. If we accept that as a goal, we can be in better shape than we are right now.
Now, we are moving here in a way that hasn't been seen for many decades. We do not have a movement, if you will, and we certainly don't have a movement that is thinking about assuming state power. It's essentially these siloized movements we have, reformist in nature, important, reformist in nature, not moving or thinking, as certainly I don't think that's really happened since the 30s, where we thought about the assumption of state power. Interestingly enough, we're way behind Europe, even in that. Having said that, certainly there are people who are aggressively responsive to the incredible chauvinism here, who are fundamentally anti-colonialist in nature. And so we do have that legacy of those movements from the 60s, the Black Power movement and all the indigenous groups and so on, and Puerto Rico groups and the anti-colonial struggles that were happening. Within that, what do you say is the message or the role here for those of us who would certainly like to be in a support capacity for our sisters and brothers who are fighting the good fight on the island of Puerto Rico? How do you see us mobilizing, and what do you need from us?
I think that there are several things. Right now there's a bill that has been pushed by two senators, Warren and Bernie Sanders. The American people can go behind that because it has to deal with the $74 billion odious debt that has been thrown on the laps of the Puerto Rican people. Also, right now, there are projects in Puerto Rico that, if helped economically, those projects can definitely advance. For example, you know, we have solar energy projects that will definitely can grow. All we need is basically for the people to see that solar energy can be to their benefit, not to depend on what is there right now. Alternatives play a very, very important role. Puerto Rico can definitely benefit
from Puerto Ricans in the diaspora. Puerto Ricans in the diaspora can talk to the Americans in the United States and be advocates for what is happening in Puerto Rico. The most important element is how is it that Puerto Rico can be helped in a way that is sustainable, in a way that can be maintained, can be pushed into a position that nobody would be able to destroy what's been created. I think that what is in the process of being created, there are projects that will guarantee the future of Puerto Rico. And I think that if we come into the United States and ask, help us economically to lift those projects, it will not be a tremendous amount of money. It will not be a costly project. It will be primarily done with the strength of the Puerto Rican people. Sometimes we surprise ourselves when we can be built a house just with very little and make it into a livable, adequate place. What we need most, people with skills, people who can help us, people, again, we need the human resource to help us too. So those are the things that I believe can be of help to us. But it cannot be a governmental structure. It cannot be FEMA. It cannot be Army Corps of Engineers. It has to come from the American citizens. It has to come from people who love freedom and justice and can see the potential that there is in Puerto Rico for liberation. Because the struggle, the people are there. We're there. And we know that the potential right now is there. Now, can we do it by ourselves? I don't think that we'll be able to do it by ourselves. We need the help. We need the support. We need the solidarity from throughout the world. And we're trying to get as much as we can, gain as much solidarity as we can. Unfortunately, it is the U.S. government that determines what gets into Puerto Rico and what doesn't get into Puerto Rico, because Cuba, Mexico, Nicaragua, Venezuela, Ecuador, Uruguay, those countries were trying to help Puerto Rico after the hurricane. And the United States prevented that, helped from getting there. So I think that's the most important thing that people can do.
Just want to say I'm honored. We certainly, in the community listening to this, pledge our support to you, to our comrades, our sisters and brothers in Puerto Rico, and for all that you have done to enhance our sensitivities about colonialism and, frankly, about what it means to commit to freedom and democracy and egalitarianism. Thank you. Thank you. It's been my pleasure. And I've been speaking with Oscar Lopez Rivera. Muchas gracias por todo.
Muchas gracias.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Welcome to the Earth First Update, bringing you all the environmental news you can use for over 20 years. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org on Thursday, March 1st, 2018. I'm asking you to please have a pencil and paper handy so you can take down names, addresses, emails, web pages, and phone numbers so you can take action for the environment. Let's start off with announcements. The California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, March 3rd, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Linda writes, we should be getting some rain starting tonight and continuing into the weekend. It should make our French broom work parties a little easier. How to get to Quail Hollow. Take Graham Hill Road from Santa Cruz. As you come down the hill into Felton, turn right at the first light and drive 2 miles up East Zianti Road and turn left on Quail Hollow Road. The park entrance is on the right side, a half a mile up. They'll meet you in the gravel parking lot on the left side of the entrance road. And once again, that's Quail Hollow Ranch County Park, 10 a.m. this Saturday, March 3rd. The Habitat Restoration Team is an all-volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Their program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80. Please wear comfortable layered clothing. There you might have a little sprinkle on Saturday morning and bring something to drink and lots of enthusiasm. They work rain or shine, but if things get particularly unpleasant, they'll call it a day. Tools are provided. Please bring your gloves and water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 831-462-4041. That's 831-462-4041. Email her at redwoodrn@pacbell.net. That's redwdrn at pacbell.net. And please visit their webpage at www.cruzcnps.org. CRUZCNPS.org. And Cascadia Forest Defenders invites you to a week-long climbing camp to come spend time in the woods, learning how to ascend and descend a static rope, traverse between trees, use a crossbow to get into the tree, build and set a platform in a tree, build road blockades involving aerial structures, and much more. It'll take place March 26th through April 1st. You're going to need to RSVP to reserve a spot and to find out where the camp is. Send that to forestdefensenow@gmail.com. That's forestdefensenow@gmail.com. Or you can go to their webpage, forestdefensenow.com. And Caltrans wants to widen the road through the Richardson Grove, likely damaging the shallow root systems of the coastal redwoods. The Environmental Protection Information Center, our allies, have sued them several times now, winning both state and federal injunctions, but Caltrans is coming back again. On Tuesday, March 6th at 2 p.m. at the Humboldt County Superior Court, there will be a hearing on Caltrans' motion to discharge the writ. Caltrans is arguing that it has done what the Court of Appeal required and that the trial court should accept their analysis as valid. We dispute this, and the court hearing will be on this issue. Whatever the judge decides can or will likely be appealed to the Court of Appeals. Come show your support for the ancient trees and endangered species of Richardson Grove State Park, the Humboldt County Gateway, the Redwood Curtain, and the magnificent old-growth forests of Humboldt County. The hearing on March 6th at 2 p.m. will be held at the Humboldt County Superior Court, Courtroom 4, 825 5th Street in Eureka, California, 95501. Try to arrive 15 to 20 minutes early to pass through security. There is plenty of two-hour parking around the courthouse. Assuming we have something to celebrate, we will reconvene after the hearing for a cider beer kombucha at the Humboldt Cider Company. Many thanks to our dedicated attorneys who have now filed 5 cases to defend Richardson Grove, and many thanks to all the dedicated activists who have held back the tractors and cement trucks for over 10 years. And a tree sit has been launched in the path of the Mountain Valley Pipeline in West Virginia. In this story from It's Going Down, the following press release was sent to It's Going Down and announces an active tree sit, Peters Mountain Stand in West Virginia against the Mountain Valley Pipeline. For background information on pipelines in West Virginia, go to their webpage. For other updates, go to Appalachians Against Pipelines. Today, Mountain Valley Pipeline LLC set out to continue preparation for a horizontal drill pad on the West Virginia side of Peters Mountain. Contractors hired by the company arrived at the site this afternoon to find a number of resistors had already taken to the trees. After almost a month of delays from their intended construction date and in anticipation of a cease as a result of federal protected species, MVP is rushing to begin the intensive process of boring a hole through the mountain. The 125-foot easement surrounding the drill site is now thoroughly defended. The company intends to construct the 42-inch natural gas pipeline in 11 simultaneous sections. However, the plan is being complicated as the company awaits permits from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and faces nearly 300 defiant landowners refusing to sign easements. While things are held up here, trees are being cut 100 miles north to prepare for the construction of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. An encampment has formed and continues to grow in the proposed pathway. Dominion Energy, the monopolizing parasite, needs the ACP to get built so they can export natural gas for profit. West Virginians or Virginians won't see any of that money while bearing the destructive consequences of extraction and construction. We know that resource extraction and the exploitation inherent to it is not new to Appalachia. It's scarred into the land. We stand in solidarity with all those who have fought for their communities and against corporate greed. We recognize that the struggle will continue today that began in 1492. Our struggle against these pipelines remains a struggle against settler colonialism. All of this to say that our struggle is far from over. They haven't even begun. In solidarity, Peters Mountain Stand. To donate to folks resisting the MVP in Virginia and West Virginia, please consider donating. And you can go to the website, It's Going Down, for that story. And up here's a news story from the Buffalo Field Campaign. Wild buffalo were released again from Yellowstone's controversial trap. Yellowstone National Park's Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap has once again been targeted. Yellowstone reports that sometime between the evening of January 21st and the morning of January 22nd, captured wild buffalo were released by someone from the Stevens Creek Capture Facility. This is the second time in about a month that the highly controversial Stevens Creek Bison Capture Facility has been targeted. The destruction of the trap fence only highlights the deadlock inherent in the current interagency bison management plan priorities, said Nez Perce Tribe and Buffalo Field Campaign board member James Holt. Approximately 96 of the country's last wild migratory buffalo, America's national mammal, had been captured in the trap days before the incident. Yellowstone National Park operates the trap as a means to appease Montana livestock interests, who told Extreme prejudice against native wild buffalo and frown upon them roaming their native Montana homelands. In mid-January, 52 bull bison were released from Yellowstone's quarantine pens. Yellowstone had been holding the bulls, some for up to 2 years, for still unapproved quarantine purposes. Quarantine is viewed by some wildlife advocates as a domestication process, a program being force-fed into indigenous buffalo cultures as the only means they will see the return of their relatives, the buffalo, to tribal lands. This second attempt to free wild buffalo from unnecessary and political confinement should send a strong message to Yellowstone National Park that there are many people who strongly oppose the current mismanagement of this American icon, said Buffalo Field Campaign's media coordinator Stephanie Shea. The Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap stands as a monument to oppression and control over beings who were born to roam free. They are the embodiment of wilderness and freedom, and these qualities are precisely the reason they were chosen to represent the nation, supposedly the land of the free. Unfortunately, Yellowstone National Park wranglers have since recaptured the released buffalo, along with a couple hundred more. Buffalo Field Campaign's Gardner Patrols reported last Friday evening that there were more than 300 buffalo in the Stevens Creek trap. And Road to Nowhere, Humboldt Redwood Company is making a mess of the Mattole in this story by Rob DePena of the Environmental Protection Information Center. Humboldt Redwood Company doesn't seem to be learning about the lessons handed down by its predecessor, the now bankrupt Pacific Lumber Company. Faced once again with community and activist resistance to its plans to log previously unharvested and extremely rare upland Douglas fir forests, the company is resorting to some very Hurwitz-era tactics by proposing to construct over 1,000 feet of new road along Long Ridge in the north branch of the North Fork of the Mattole watershed for the seemingly the sole purpose of circumnavigating community and activist resistance to its logging plans. In other words, they're building a road around a roadblock. HRC has proposed a major amendment to THP 1-12-026-HUM, the Long Ridge Cable THP, erroneously arguing that the new road segment is necessary to facilitate greater access to the Mattole property for timber management and fire suppression activities, without offering any explanation or rationale as to why the pre-existing road network, which it has already used to conduct partial harvesting operations, is not sufficient to do the job. Behind the scenes is a live and real controversy over the company's claim that the forests to be logged are not primary forests as defined by the Forest Stewardship Council, triggering additional conservation requirements and HRC's refusal to entertain a proposal by the local community to purchase the land for conservation purposes. Why? The answer seems to be that HRC bought damaged goods from Pacific Lumber on the whole as a property investment, and the forests of the North Branch of the North Fork of the Mattole represent the last of the best of what the company has left to work with to meet the financial bottom line for their owners, the San Francisco-based billionaire Fisher family, which is notorious for the Gap Clothing Company. HRC, Epic, and Mattole community interests and activists have spent the better part of the last 5 years interacting over the potential fate and management of the North Branch of the North Fork Mattole Holdings, with Humboldt Redwood Company once promising an open and transparent collaborative solution-based process. For years, HRC honored that agreement, and we made headway in addressing the controversy. Forest defenders came out of the woods, and there was a truce. That has unfortunately ended as HRC announced its plans to move forward, simply announcing its findings and decisions without any effort to collaboratively or openly solve the continuing disputes through direct dialogues. Faced with Mattole community and activist resistance to the logging it proposes, Humboldt Redwood Company has chosen to forge stubbornly ahead and propose what is clearly unnecessarily additional road construction under false and erroneous pretenses. And five more people have been charged in Tanzania for the murder of an anti-poaching activist in this story from Reuters. I'm sorry, I cannot pronounce the author's name. Five more suspects were charged in a Tanzanian court on Friday for the murder of a prominent conservationist, Wayne Lotter, bringing to 8 the total number of people arraigned over the killing. Three other suspects were charged for the same crime in October last year. Lotter, 51, co-founder of the PAMS Foundation USA, a non-governmental organization that supports anti-poaching efforts across Africa, was shot dead in Tanzania's commercial capital, Dar es Salaam, on August 16, 2017. The five suspects charged yesterday include a Burundian national, aged 40 years, who was also known by the alias The Priest, according to court documents seen by Reuters. The other suspects arranged on Friday at the Kisutu Resident Magistrate's Court. I can't read their names either. The suspects who were charged with murder and conspiracy to commit murder were not allowed to enter a plea until the case is transferred to the Tanzanian High Court, which has jurisdiction over murder cases. The case was adjourned until March 6th, when it is scheduled to come up for another mentioning. Lauder supported an elite Tanzanian anti-poaching unit that has had a number of successful arrests in recent years, colleagues said. He also worked on the Ivory Queen case, which saw Yang Fenglan, a Chinese person charged with running a smuggling empire that stretched from East Africa to Asian markets. She denies the charges in a separate ongoing court case in Tanzania. It was unclear if Lauder's death was related to his work, colleagues said. His assailant reportedly stole his laptop, said two colleagues who declined to be named. We are relieved that some of the perpetrators responsible for his untimely death have been apprehended and are being brought to justice, PAM's foundation said in a statement. And happy birthday, number 19, to the Headwaters Forest Reserve, in this story by Rob DiPerna of the Environmental Protection Information Center. Headwaters Forest Reserve, located just south of Eureka, California, celebrates its 19th birthday anniversary today, March 1st. The 7,500-acre reserve was established at the climax of the nearly 15-year-long campaign to save Headwaters Forest and stands today as a critical ecological refugia and lineage to the primeval past for many critically threatened and endangered species. The Headwaters Forest Reserve also stands today as a place for pioneering redwood forest restoration, a place for connecting community and visitors to stories of the past, and to a better vision of the future. 19 years after the controversial last-minute consummation of the landmark Headwaters Forest Agreement, known to most activists in conservation as the Deal, on March 1, 1999, the landscape that now embodies the Headwaters Forest Reserve in many ways bears little resemblance to the landscape or the times when it was first established. The so-called Death Road, constructed into the heart of Headwaters Grove by Pacific Lumber Company, has been removed and decommissioned. Once raw, the barren clearcuts authored by Pacific Lumber Company and Elk River Timber Company are beginning to regrow and heal. The young, overdense, biologically sterile forest plantations established in the wake of the industrial clearcuts have been thinned, restoring both stem count, species composition, and stem density ratios to more natural and healthy conditions. Today, the Forest Headwaters Reserve is a place where people and history can intersect and where stewards of the future can learn the lessons from the stewards of the past. And the Steve Irwin departs for the Great Australian Bight in this story from Sea Shepherd Conservation Society Australia. On March 2nd, the motor yacht Steve Irwin will depart Sea Shepherd Southern Operations Base in Williamstown, Victoria, for Port Adelaide, South Australia. It will be the first stop in preparation for Sea Shepherd's second expedition into the Great Australian Bight. Back in 2016, our expedition, Operation Jadara, showcased the beauty and grandness of the Bight, a globally unique home to one of the world's most significant southern right whale nurseries, Jeff Hansen, managing director of Sea Shepherd Australia, said. What we found in the Bight was nothing short of remarkable, a place worthy of the utmost protection and no place for an oil field. Since Sea Shepherd's expedition in 2016, both British Petroleum, BP, and Chevron have pulled out of this, putting a marine in wilderness area at risk, and however, other big players remain like Statoil and Santos, Jeff added. This time, Sea Shepherd will take our supporters on a journey beneath the waves to showcase the incredible diversity in the sanctuary zones of Pearson, Top Gallant, Ward, and Flinders Islands. We'll highlight why marine sanctuaries are vital and reiterate that the Bight is too precious to risk at the hands of big oil. For an oil spill in the Bight would be impossible to clean up and could devastate most of South Australia's coastline and offshore islands like Kangaroo Island, Jeff said. The motor yacht Steve Irwin will arrive in Port Adelaide on Sunday, March 4th, and will remain there until March 19th, with three public tours on March 10th, 11th, 12th, and 17th. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field. It's just below zero as we trek through fresh fallen snow on an unusually windless day early in the morning on the high hills above the Gardner Basin. Taking advantage of the calm air that won't rock our scopes and cameras, our patrol is on the way to a lookout spot high above Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Buffalo Trap. The trap is miles away. The spot we're at is one of the few places that can even see the faraway glimpse into the industrial-sized monstrosity that has trapped more than 450 of the gentle giants in the past couple of weeks. Yellowstone initiates a massive 7-mile public closure around their trap, obviously wanting to hide the horrible things they are doing to this sacred species, our national mammal. On our way to the lookout, our footsteps squeaking through the freezing cold snow, one of our crew shouts out, "Wolves!" We all stop dead in our tracks. To the south of us, we can hear them, the beautiful, haunting serenade of a wolf pack, singing blessing songs to the morning, or more like mourning songs to the travesty unfolding before us. The wolves know. We get to the lookout spot, and it's as bad as we thought. Hundreds of buffalo in the trap, huddled together, eating hay, trapped in death row. Four Pike Wranglers are on horseback, and a white SUV are coming into the northernmost paddock of the trap, which holds approximately 60 of the country's last wild buffalo. This paddock is the veritable end of the line before the buffalo go into even deeper to places they will never return from. Genocide, our Blackfeet brother says. We nod in agreement. The U.S. government continues the systematic destruction of the sacred buffalo, and for the same reasons, too. Only these days, instead of Buffalo Bill and Wild Bill Cody, they call it management, and the killers are the so-called good guys in green. Yellowstone National Park. Donning buffalo on their uniform badges, they are the very ones who are obligated to protect the buffalo who are the main reason this park even exists, that people even come here. These caretakers are facilitating all of the trapping and most of the killing. As we watch through our scopes and binoculars, eyes teary from the blistering cold and the pain in our hearts, the wranglers go in for the attack. It's just another day in the park. Frantic, the 60 buffalo run away from the wranglers, but the only path open to them is the dark corridor that leads into the labyrinth of the trap, towards the bullpen and the squeeze chute, towards the end of freedom and family, into the tiny holding pens where they will spend their last hour in shit and fear before being loaded into livestock trailers headed for the slaughterhouse. The mournful howling continues. The wolves know. We join in. And Congo has approved logging near carbon-rich peatlands in this story written by Reuters. Congo's environment minister said on Tuesday it had reinstated thousands of square kilometers of logging concessions in its equatorial forests, a move environmentalists fear could cause huge volumes of greenhouse gases to be released. The forests cover peatlands, believed to contain billions of tons of carbon dioxide, and scientists are concerned that any disruption could release massive amounts of greenhouse gases blamed for climate change into the atmosphere. In a statement, the Democratic Republic of Congo's environment ministry said the peatlands would not be threatened because they lie in zones that are geographically unexploitable. Environmental groups also said Environment Minister Amy M. Botobe's decision to grant 6,500 square kilometers, about 2,500 square miles, in concessions earlier this month to two Chinese-owned companies violates a 2002 moratorium Congo imposed on new industrial logging titles. The ministry said in response that its actions did not violate the moratorium since the concessions in question had already been exploited. The Congo Basin is the world's second largest rainforest, and over half of its 500 million hectares, about 100 billion acres, lies within Congo's borders. The forest is home to rare species, including forest elephants and dwarf chimpanzees. And startling orangutan population declines have been recorded in Borneo, in this story written by Will Dunham of Reuters. Hunting by people and habitat destruction by palm oil, paper, logging, and mining industries helped drive a startling drop of about 50% in the orangutan population on the island in Borneo from 1999 to 2015, scientists said. The researchers calculated the population decrease of 148,500 during that 16-year period and projected another drop of 45,000 by 2050, painting a bleak picture for the future of these shaggy, reddish tree dwellers that are among the world's most imperiled great apes. Orangutans inhabit lowland forests on Borneo, an island shared by Indonesia, Malaysia, and Brunei, and Indonesia's island of Sumatra, where they eat wild fruits, insects, bark, flowers, and leaves. Deforestation is only part of the danger. Around 70% of the loss in Borneo's populations may have resulted from orangutan killings by people in forested areas, the researchers said. People have hunted orangutans for their meat on Borneo since they colonized the area, as they hunt for other edible animals, said biologist Maria Voigt of the German Center for Integrative Biodiversity Research and the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. The orangutans are not their preferred prey species. This is rather pigs and deer, but they also take one when they encounter them. Killing also occurs in situations where humans are frightened or startled by orangutans, for example, when orangutans enter gardens or plantations to eat their crops. Researchers tallied our burial nests for these apes and used satellite images to appraise forest loss, determining that there were between 200 and 300,000 Borneo orangutans in 1999 and only 70,000 to 100,000 remaining in 2015. Is it disheartening that despite all the conservation's efforts, we still see these declines? But we need to maintain optimism because of if the forests remain and we reduce the killings to zero, we can over time see a rebound of orangutan numbers, Liverpool John Moores University ecologist Sergey Welch said. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon. That's Friday at 3 p.m. as part of our Environment Friday programming. You could also listen to WMNB 107.1 in North Adams, Massachusetts, Friday at 5:30 in the morning, KRFP 90.3 Moscow, Idaho, Wednesdays at 3 p.m., KOWA 106.5 in Olympia, Washington, Saturdays at 7 a.m., WLSL 92.7 in Dade City, Florida, Sundays at noon. You can also listen to KHCF 89.9 in Morgan Hill and Gilroy, California, KGIG at 104.9 in Modesto, California, and KPHD 93.3 in Modesto, California, Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1 in Berkeley, California, and coming up soon, KBOG 97.9 in Bandon, Oregon. Grateful Dread Public Radio is on the internet at gdprrevolution.com. That's gdprrevolution.com, Sundays at 2 a.m. Central Time. Or you could always go to radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, for all.net, where you can listen online or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. I'd like to ask you to please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and broadcast. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio, produced at the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and please do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Against the grain, the Paris Commune, the Mexican Revolution, the Spanish Revolution. Some of the most important social upheavals fomented by radicals were led or populated by anarchists. Yet most of us have very little knowledge of what the anarchist tradition is actually about, and the ideas of anarchism are often conflated with particular strategies or tactics. I'm Sasha Lilly. We'll take a look at a film series that attempts to set the record straight after these news headlines.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. Donald Trump set to meet at this hour with a bipartisan group of lawmakers on the issue of school safety and gun legislation. Senate Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said Democrats would press Trump to follow through on his vaguely worded call for comprehensive background checks for gun buyers.
Well, we Democrats are calling on him today to keep his word. We've sent him a letter. And we're asking him to support existing legislation, bipartisan legislation, that close the loopholes that allow anyone to purchase a gun at a gun show or on the Internet without a background check. These loopholes make no sense.
Heavy security at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School as classes resumed for the first time since the Valentine's Day massacre 2 weeks ago that killed 17 students and teachers. Police say a teacher who fired a gun inside a Georgia classroom taught social studies and was the play-by-play announcer for the high school's football team. Dalton police say 53-year-old Jesse Davidson was taken into custody after a 30 to 45-minute standoff with police. Authorities say he was inside a locked classroom with no students present when he apparently fired a handgun. Police haven't said why he fired the gun. Dozens of people have blocked the streets surrounding the San Francisco headquarters of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The protest comes in the wake of federal immigration officials announcing they arrested more than 150 people in Northern California since Sunday. Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf had warned residents Saturday night. Credible sources told her a sweep was coming. The acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Thomas Homan blasted the mayor, calling her warning a reckless decision based on a political agenda. Schaaf defended the decision and said, quote, it is Oakland's legal right to be a sanctuary city. We have not broken any laws. We believe our community is safer when families stay together. A protest is underway outside the ICE headquarters at 630 Sansom Street at this hour. Top California environmental officials testified in favor of the federal Clean Power Plan at a San Francisco hearing. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency is holding so-called listening sessions on the Trump administration's proposed repeal of the plan. The Obama-era plan required states to set goals for reducing carbon dioxide emissions from electrical generating plants by the year 2030. Deputy Director of the California Energy Commission, Courtney Smith, said the state's power generating infrastructure is vulnerable to the effects of climate change.
More than a dozen of our electric generation facilities are located less than 4 feet above high tide, making them highly vulnerable to storm surge and sea level rise. The increase in frequency and severity of wildfires is threatening transmission lines and other key electric system infrastructure.
California officials say the state already has met the requirements of the Clean Power Plan 4 years ago, 15 years early, and that other states can too. Russian President Vladimir Putin made a disputed claim that a large number of Syrian civilians left the besieged rebel-held area of eastern Ghouta today during the Russian-ordered five-hour pause in conflicts. At the United Nations, the Humanitarian and Emergency Relief Coordinator Mark Lowcock said no civilians had left the region. I'm Eileen Alfandari. News headlines return at 4. Please join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, anarchism has been the leading tendency among young radicals. Yet its remarkable history is long and in many ways quite different from the present-day anarchism that we know. It was rooted in mass workers' and peasant movements, spanned the globe, reaching the edges of empires, and put tremendous fear in the hearts of the ruling classes. A three-part documentary film series by director Tancred Ramonet aims to shine a light on that storied past. It's called No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism, and it's our pleasure to air it as a means to raise money for this radio station, which was, in fact, founded by anarchists in 1949. The film traces classical anarchism from its inception in the 1840s, to its explosive growth at the turn of the 20th century and perhaps its greatest moment in the Spanish Revolution, where anarchists attempted to set up a libertarian communist society. And we should bear in mind that the word libertarian here is used in the European sense to be liberatory, not in the American anti-collectivist right-wing sense. The box set of the three-hour documentary is available to you for your pledge of $180 to KPFA. Let's take a listen to edited excerpts from No Gods, No Masters, starting with this one on the Paris Commune, the uprising of the workers of France's capital in 1871, which mentions Bakunin, the 19th century Russian anarchist thinker.
When the Paris Commune broke out in 1871, the anarchists were in the forefront. And along with the other revolutionaries, they threw themselves wholeheartedly into the insurrection.
It was the great hope, the dream, a whole city suddenly becoming autonomous, ridding itself of its masters, of the old world, and reinventing everything.
For 73 days, Paris rose up, shot a few generals, burned land registers, toppled the old idols, and returned power to the people. On the ruins of the old order, the revolutionaries within the International set aside divisions and together tried to build a better world. Everyone was supplied according to their needs. The poor were fed, the illiterate taught to read and write, and the disabled cared for. Church and state were separated. The arts became accessible to all. Women were given an education, the vote, and control over their bodies. And the city worked almost without any government.
In the real sense, the Commune was not an anarchist event. It was a first attempt at destroying the state immediately and entirely. There was the idea of a sudden uprising and the capture of a capital's economic and political life by the population itself.
The Paris Commune may not have been anarchist, but those who proclaimed themselves to be anarchists, or those who soon would, such as Louis Michel, were in the front line. And when the movement spread to French cities such as Lyon, Bakunin himself took part in the insurrection. Within a few days, the state had been abolished. He believed the Grand Soir had finally arrived. But the government was already striking back. The Communards raised the barricades and prepared for battle. In the course of a long week, in Haussmann's Paris, a civil war broke out in which workers, men, women, and children were pitched against a trained army. The ensuing counter-revolutionary backlash reflected the fear that the Commune had struck into the hearts of the bourgeoisie. The troops fired indiscriminately. The pride of the proletariat was cut down as Paris became a mass grave.
It was a massacre that's difficult to imagine today. The number of dead has long been disputed. 25,000, 30,000, probably closer to 20,000. Killing 20,000 people within a week using the firearms of the day would have been practically impossible. The killing ceased on May 28, 1871, because the earth, the gutters, and the sewers of Paris were overflowing with blood.
The brutality of the suppression of the Paris Commune shocked many people on the left in Europe, and many people, many Europeans in general, actually. This was seen as, interpreted by some anarchists as a sign that if the ruling class is going to behave like this, then we can behave how we like to. We can respond in the same kind of terms.
They said this proves that you cannot have peaceful change, because if you try any other way, you're just going to get massacred like the communards were. And if you try to do things peacefully, they would shoot you down.
Many anarchists died in the bloodshed, while many others were banished to the Caledonian penal colonies. The few to avoid death or the wrath of the state were condemned to exile and misery. With their numbers diminished, the Marxists seized the movement to expel anarchists from the International. But anarchism survived. Bakunin managed to flee in disguise. He gathered his last forces in his Saint-Imier stronghold in Switzerland in the Jura Mountains, sealing an alliance that would herald the official birth of his movement.
At that time, there were around 15 of them, 12 young people aged between 20 and 30, who had come from Spain, Italy, and Switzerland. The others were a little older, Bakunin, along with the Spaniard, and Gustave Lefrançais, a communard.
They set up a new organization. Historians do not include them in the ranks of the International. This was a new organization. At least the name he gave it couldn't have been more unambiguous, the Anti-Authoritarian International.
The National Working Men's Association adopted a range of measures, foremost of which was a duty to destroy all political power. So for the first time, an organization with stated anarchist objectives came into existence.
In Saint-Imier, by signing an alliance of friendship, solidarity, and mutual defense, the anarchists seized their independence. They drew up a charter, an organization, and a program. Organizational horizontality, anti-authoritarianism, revolutionary radicalism, internationalism, atheism, free speech, free thought, equality for all, and rejection of party politics. Every aspect of libertarian thinking was collected here for the first time. The anarchists even invented a new weapon, the widespread use of which would have the capacity to destroy any political power and launch a revolution.
The main instrument of the revolution was the general strike. This was a new term coined in Saint-Imier. Trade unionism did not yet exist, much less the concept of anarcho-syndicalism. But everything was ready and in place. The aim wasn't to exist or carry on, it was to start a revolution.
In the nascent United States of America, that large-scale use of this new weapon would be seen for the first time. Introduced in the great waves of migrations, anarchism took root here too. Among the battalions of poor people who came to swell the industrial centers of the North, where wage earners resembled nothing so much as Southern slaves, conditions were conducive to its development. In no small part because in the early 1880s, the Civil War dragged on in social struggles such as Pennsylvania's Great Railroad Strike, which the federal government countered by sending in the army. Bayonet charges claimed dozens of workers' lives. For newcomers, the American dream often turned into one long nightmare.
The common story of immigrant anarchists, be they German or Jewish or Italian, they are either skilled workers who can only find unskilled employment, or unskilled workers who can only find the most demeaning of work. So they become disillusioned with the economic opportunities available to them. They become disillusioned with the political system, which they know vaguely is supposed to be democratic and republican, but which they find in this time period is dominated by corruption, by corporate power, and some of these disillusioned immigrants then encounter radical ideas.
This encounter with radical ideas occurred notably in Chicago, a city that immigrants flooded into. Steel, concrete, and the meat industry needed manpower. Plagued with a rising mafia in the pay of the all-powerful industrialists, the city was overflowing with segregated workers, prostitutes, and street children. It was fast becoming the home of protest.
Chicago was the center of anarchist activity in the United States in the 1880s.
It was a city in which labor relations were pretty harsh. There was basically no room for negotiation, no room for compromise. So there really was a situation, the stark situation in which you had the workers often living in unbelievably harsh conditions, and a local ruling class, a local business elite that was not prepared to make any concessions whatsoever towards them.
Inspired by the new anarchist strategy, in 1886, on May 1st, then just a day like any other, a general strike was called. 340,000 workers gathered to demand an eight-hour day. The police broke up the demonstration forcefully. Walls became covered with calls for revenge. 2 days later, the anarchists organized a protest in Haymarket Square. The event was to become a key moment in the history of the workers' movement.
Few of the leading anarchists of the city spoke against what had happened. And during that demonstration, the police arrived in force. And at some point in that night, the police moved in to try and clear the demonstration.
Somebody threw a homemade bomb at the police. It exploded, killing and injuring several officers who then opened fire on the crowd.
A few people were killed. There was a shootout. Police pulled out their guns and started shooting at people. And some of the people in the crowd, including, I'm sure, some anarchists, had come armed. And to this day, of course, Americans like to carry weapons around with them. The authorities decided that the anarchists were to blame, even though they didn't have any hard evidence.
The Chicago police rounded up dozens of anarchists and arrested anarchists who they blamed for the event, blamed for the bombing, one of whom had never been there, two of whom had never even been at the demonstration that night. So this was seen as, this, in some ways, was the classic example of reactionary forces within a particular city, Chicago in this case, using an event like this to justify an exemplary act of repression.
Eight anarchists were accused of throwing the bomb. In his plea, the prosecutor hinted at their innocence.
We know that these eight men are no guiltier than the thousands who follow them, but they've been singled out because they are leaders. Gentlemen of the jury, make an example of them. Hang them, and you will be saving our institutions and our society.
And that is an excerpt from the three documentary series, No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism. It is a French production. The director is Tancred Ramonet. And we are really pleased to be able to offer you the box set of this documentary film series for your pledge of support to KPFA. It is just out on DVD in the United States. And if you pledge right now at the rate of $180 or more, you can get the box set. It's 3-hour-long documentaries about the history of classical anarchism from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century. And it also includes a number of bonuses, an interview with America's most famous anarchist, Noam Chomsky, and a booklet of essays. And it can be yours if you call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or go to kpfa.org and pledge at the rate of $180 or more. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain, and I'm so very pleased to be able to offer this thank you gift today, because what this documentary series does is it restores the history of anarchism partly to the history of the left, because it is often forgotten, and more broadly to our sense of history, because as you've been listening from these excerpts, you will see that this series looks at the Paris Commune, the role of anarchists in the Paris Commune of 1871, at the intense class struggle that took place in the United States, often forgotten that the United States was the site of the most violent class struggle of industrialized countries in the world. And so what happened to these who later were known as the Haymarket Martyrs, the immigrant workers who had been rounded up, some of the leaders, and framed. That is part of the history. It also talks about the tactic of the general strike, and that, of course, something that has come back not too long ago, including in the 2006 immigrant workers' strike in the United States, which is the largest general strike in U.S. history, that there's deep history to these things. And a lot of this is connected to the anarchist tradition, which is very poorly understood, even by people on the left. So this series hopes to correct that, and I'm very pleased to be able to offer it to you. Of course, with documentaries, all of them, we play the sound, and the sound is all you hear. You can't see the images. But this series is full of really amazing, captivating archival footage. I don't know where they dug this stuff up, but the whole documentary is just alive, crackles with the activity of the people struggling in the past. And there are also historians and critics who comment and lend their insight into understanding these movements, but is visually extremely compelling and well put together. And I think you would benefit from owning this documentary, maybe giving it as a gift, I should say documentary series. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And there's a lot in this series. It covers so much, and I do want to go to some more audio from it. But I do want you to remember this number and call and pledge, 1-800-439-5732, or go to kpfa.org. In the next clip we're going to play, the series continues to look at anarchism in the Americas, first in the United States, and then with the Mexican Revolution.
For 50 years on the continent of America, anarchists formed the backbone of social action. They were members of the industrial workers of the world, which spread its wings from Canada to Australia. They fought alongside FORA, the huge Argentine Workers' Federation. In Bolivia, they gave FOI a red and black flag as its emblem. In Chile, they organized mass demonstrations, and among the ranks of FORU, in Uruguay, they led shows of strength on the streets of Montevideo. They controlled the docks in the Caribbean, opposed fledgling banana republics, and fought for the independence of Cuba and Puerto Rico. United States, they protested on roller skates against unemployment and against war, brandishing the skull and crossbones. It was the anarchists, and not the communists, who prompted within successive U.S. governments, despite the famous Red Scare, their darkest fears. In 1917, during yet another witch hunt, mass roundups were organized. Thousands of foreign anarchists were arrested as a prevention, held in prisons, and finally deported on the Buford, ever so subtly nicknamed the Soviet Ark. And as the land of liberty feared libertarians more than anything else, propaganda was spread against a backdrop of ragtime, smiles, and cartoons. Cartoons that amalgamated anarchist and Bolshevik vermin, assimilating them to rats that needed exterminating. Cartoons made by a joyous captain of industry who would end up showing his affection for the Nazi Party.
The United States is a country where the war against trade unions and other workers' movements was of an unparalleled brutality in the Western world, a brutality often enforced by the powers that be, aided by the mafia. Sounds unbelievable, but it's true. The government worked with the mafia to break the trade unions and the workers' movements.
And while Europe was on the point of engaging in a war which would kill millions of workers, although it's not always remembered, anarchists in Mexico were behind the first great libertarian revolution.
It's hard to understand why the Mexican Revolution doesn't have the same importance attached to it as the Russian Revolution or the Chinese Revolution, but it was the first major revolution of the 20th century.
The Mexican Revolution begins at the end of 1910. And in its early stages, 1910, 1911, 1912, one of the factions, the major factions fighting within the Mexican Revolution was the Partido Liberal Mexicano, the PLM, which is led by the Magón brothers, Enrique and Ricardo Flores Magón, who are Mexican anarchists in exile in the United States when the revolution breaks out.
Flores Magón and his comrades played a fundamental role. As the precursors of this revolutionary movement, they created the conditions necessary for the revolution. You could say that they were a constant inspiration for all the other revolutionary factions. Their propaganda continuously pushed the other factions to be more radical. Magón, in fact, regarded the Mexican Revolution as the first act in the great worldwide conflagration which was just around the corner. For him, the global libertarian revolution was just about to take off.
The Mexican Liberal Party, which was at the origin of the revolution, was liberal and a party in nothing but name. But it was well and truly an anarchist organization, as can be seen from its manifesto, written by Ricardo Flores Magón. Its place in the purest libertarian tradition was not only because it advocated direct action, but also, and above all, by virtue of its call for vast agrarian reform. For it has to be remembered that since its beginnings, the anarchist movement was the only form of socialism to assign a central role in the revolutionary process to farm workers. Furthermore, this explains its success in a Mexico which was still highly agricultural. And this concept spread. It inspired the three other mass revolutionary organizations. Emiliano Zapata's insurrectionary army in the south, the House of the World Worker in the capital in the center, and the Mexican branch of the IWW, which had opened in the north. And the slogan which Flores Magón and the anarchists of the PLM placed at the bottom of their writings was taken up by these movements and became the rallying cry of the entire revolution, land and liberty.
They said to the peasants, grab a Winchester in hand and take the land because it belongs to you. You don't have to wait for the working class to develop. The peasants could have their own revolution.
Magón had confidence in the spontaneity of an armed populace. That is to say that he considered an armed uprising, a fight to the death against the system, to be the way of establishing a libertarian society.
This call to arms resounded as strongly here as it did on the slopes of the Sierra Madre and the high ground of the Chiapas, where peasants had lived for 400 years in a state of extreme misery. Evangelization, the encomienda, and smallpox had done their work. The native peoples had been almost entirely wiped out. The womb of the Pachamama was desecrated daily, and the whole subcontinent was bled dry, humiliated, and corrupted. Placed under the control of a handful of latifundists who owned all the land, the vast majority of workers survived with no prospect of betterment. The day-to-day life of these men and women was illiteracy, famine, and illness, and back-breaking work beneath the blazing sun, which burnt celluloid and skin alike. Shouts and blows were the only encouragement, and confiscation the only reward. The slightest gesture of revolt was punished with a whip, and any attempt to escape, as in the times of slavery, by death.
In 1911, the Magones organize an invasion of northern Mexico, of Baja California. There's a group of around 50 Italian anarchists from the United States and Canada who cross the border to join the PLM's forces. There are dozens of members of the IWW. There are African-American radicals who join. There's at least one Chinese partisan. They invade the city of Mexicali in northern Mexico, seize it from federal troops, maintain control of it, and then they also seize Tijuana. And for a period of a few months, they control this area of northern Mexico.
The small army of the MLP, surrounded by the IWW and led by General Mosby, seen here on horseback, opened the prisons, and flew the black flag over the Land and Liberty Commune.
And that is an edited excerpt from the documentary film series No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism. It's directed by Tancred Ramonet, and it is 3 hours long, three-hour-long documentaries, along with a bonus interview with Noam Chomsky and a booklet of essays, all yours for a pledge of $180 or more to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm so pleased to be able to offer in this hour this documentary series because it is extremely well produced, and not often do we have wonderfully well-produced documentaries about radical history. But this is that. And it's, I think, really important for us today to understand the history of classical anarchism because it has really just been lost. It is certainly not something you're going to find out about in your history books. But in many ways, it's also slipped out of the history of the left. And although anarchism has had renewed popularity in recent years, particularly since the early 1990s with the disintegration of the Soviet Union, the continuity between the anarchism of the past and anarchism of the present, well, it's very different. And I think there's a lot to be learned by looking at that historical anarchism, that classical anarchism, much of it which was class struggle anarchism, to see why it was such an incredibly widespread popular radical tendency in the late 19th century. I mean, it's forgotten in the history of the 20th century, and a particular history of the 20th century left tends to dominate. But in fact, the turn of the 20th century and the late 19th century, by far anarchism was the strongest radical tendency in the world. And its history is fascinating. It's a very noble history, as well as a very complicated history. And one of the arguments that the director is in effect making in the course of this series is that anarchism is actually very complex with a lot of different tendencies and ideas that are not at all one and the same. But the way that anarchism tends to be understood in the present is really static and narrow. And there just is not a sense of the breadth of ideas and debates within anarchism. And at a time where I think people would like to reclaim the possibility of another world, of structuring the world in a different way, there is a lot to learn from the theory and the practice of the anarchist tradition, because as hopefully the excerpts I'm playing today will illustrate, anarchists were centrally involved in some of the most important attempts by radicals to try and create another world, whether the Paris Commune, the Mexican Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and as we'll hear later in the program, the Spanish Revolution. All of these were attempts to try and create another world where people with no gods and no masters, in effect, without borders, without kings and rulers or dictators or oligarchs, societies where internationalism would prevail and where collectivity and a shared sense of directing society would be central to the way the society was structured. Contrary to the received idea that anarchism is about chaos and no rules, this history actually shows something quite different, that it is about, the history of anarchism has been about order of a particular kind, an organization of a particular kind. And some of that, and some of these attempts are actually very inspiring, as we will hear with the excerpts about the Spanish Revolution. And this documentary series, which discusses all of this, can be yours for your pledge of $180 or more by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go to kpfa.org, where you can find this series available, as well as all sorts of other thank you gifts. And I should say that we are always looking for phone volunteers at KPFA Studios, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley. That's half a block north of University Avenue. It would be lovely to have your help in that way as well. So please give what you can right now. I do want to get to more from this series, but let me just tell you a bit more what's in each of these documentaries individually. As I say, there are three parts. Each one is an hour. The first part goes from the period 1840 to 1906. It is a time where anarchism emerges as the leading tendency of protest against the Industrial Revolution. And it talks about early anarchist thought from Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, Mikhail Bakunin, the role of anarchists in the Revolutionary Paris Commune of 1871, the emergence of the general strike and anarchist anarcho-syndicalism, the Haymarket Affair, which we heard a little bit about in one of the clips I just played, in which four anarchist leaders were framed for a bomb that went off during a demonstration. Part two takes us from 1907 to 1921 and the heady years of the Mexican Revolution, which started in 1910. The ideas of the Flores Magón brothers, leading anarchist thinkers, and then the tragic story of anarchists in the Russian Revolution, who, of course, participated in the Russian Revolution and then were repressed by the Bolsheviks, and then also the history of repression of anarchists in the United States, in Europe, out of World War I, and the consequences of World War I for radical movements, including anarchist movements, when so many people were killed fighting in World War I. And then part three looks at the case of Sacco and Vanzetti in the United States, the way that anarchists were characterized in the U.S., which in many ways is a characterization that hasn't gone away. It looks at trade unionism and the fight for workers' rights and the way the state came down so heavily against anarchists. And it looks at the story of the Spanish Revolution of 1936. And we're going to hear some from that. But I did want to announce that we have a match that's put up by one donor, an anonymous donor in Richmond. And this person says, if you will donate, she or he will match you dollar for dollar up to $250. So they're not asking you to pledge the whole amount. They just want you to pledge what you can, and hopefully collectively we can make this match. So it's a way to basically stretch your dollars further. If you're intrigued by this film, if you'd like to support KPFA, now is the time to do so by pledging calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or kpfa.org. $180 or more will get you the box set, 3 hours, plus an interview with Noam Chomsky, plus a booklet of essays, No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism. And I'm going to just take a bit of a leap of faith here that you will call and pledge during this matching period while we have this challenge on the line so that we can go to some more audio from this really fantastic documentary series. And this one, this excerpt is from part three of this series, and it starts with the lead up to the revolution in Spain, which broke out in 1936. And it mentions the anarchist leader, the Spanish anarchist leader, Buenaventura Durruti, and the Ukrainian anarchist revolutionary Nestor Makhno. But here is the film, No Gods, No Masters, discussing the lead up to the revolution in Spain, 1936.
Ce que les anarchistes...
What the anarchists represented and aspired to was a very lofty ideal that would take a lot of preparation. In Spain, they had been preparing for 70 to 80 years for the Spanish Civil War. So when revolution hit Spain, people were ready because they had been preparing a long time for it.
In
1936, in Spain, the anarchists weren't only prepared because since the late 19th century, they had carried out a number of propagandist of the deed missions, like the attacks by by the mysterious Mano Negra, Black Hand, or the 1912 assassination of the Prime Minister by Manuel Fariña Serrano. Neither was it because some of the major martyrs of the cause, like the suspected anarchists garroted in Jerez de la Frontera, Francisco Ferrer, and the peasants murdered in the Casas Viejas, were Spanish. Nor was it because the Catalan anarchist newspaper rang out the same slogan ad for the Mexican Revolution. And nor was it because some of the major peasant and factory worker uprisings had taken place in the Levante, in Andalusia, in the Rioja, in Catalonia, and finally in Asturias with the October Revolution, quashed by the young General Franco under orders from the recently elected center-right government. No, Spanish anarchists were ready because the libertarian movement had been solidly organized from its earliest days. Firstly, within a powerful Spanish section of the Workers' International Industrial Union, then within the FAI, the Iberian Anarchist Federation, and the CNT, the National Confederation of Labor, which, on the eve of Franco's coup d'etat, was one of the best-structured unions in the world with the most members.
The world is vast, but it wasn't only Western Europe that had the strongest union power. But that wasn't all. The biggest organized social power, not political, because the term is ambiguous, was the CNT.
By late spring 1936, the National Confederation of Labor had about 1.5 million members throughout Spain, including half of all Catalonians.
With only one single paid bureaucrat, which is quite incredible if you think about it. One paid person in an organization that big.
In 1936, Macno had died and Urruti had returned to Spain. Elections took place. Anarchist groups, which presented no candidates, urged their members to vote for the Spanish Popular Front. And with millions of libertarian votes, the left wing won with a tiny minority and a government formed including socialists, Republican Democrats, and a handful of communists. The reaction from the right wing was swift. General Franco ordered all army regiments to take control of the country. Civil war had begun.
Franco's coup d'etat came about in 1936, and Spain burst open like a watermelon. On one side was the Progressive Front, and on the other, the Fascist Front. And for 3 years, it was a violent face-off.
Like in Italy and in Germany, the upper classes applauded the putsch. Captains of industry provided finance for the fascists, and the Democrats abdicated. The government of the Popular Front, rather than call for resistance, resigned 3 times in 1 day. The people were left to their own devices as half of the country fell under Franco's control. Libertarian groups launched an appeal for a general mobilization, and suddenly, in all spontaneity, as one, the anarchists answered the call. In Catalonia, led by Durruti, in charge of defending Barcelona, libertarians fended off right-wing forces. To the Barricades, the hymn of the CNT, written by Valeriano Orobon Fernandez, a leading anarcho-syndicalist theoretician, in just a few hours became the battle cry of half a nation. Columns formed. Urruti was appointed delegated commander of a militia made up of volunteer freedom fighters. The column, with 3,000 men and women divided into several centuries, named after significant martyrs such as Sacco and Vanzetti, the Urruti column, along with the red and black column, marched on Zaragoza, then converged one Aragon to confront the fascist armies. Inspired by the Macnovists, Urruti and his troops fought a war and led a revolution.
Fascism into a retreat, which later the Republican armies were unable to do. But that was notably in Aragon. And the moment that the Durruti columns liberated a village, they immediately proclaimed libertarian communism.
In cada pueblo aragonés In every liberated village, members of the Daruti column talked to the peasants. The anarchists told them to do away with the hedges separating the fields and to create vast collective zones and to work the land all together.
As they advanced, the libertarians chased out masters and gods and declared the end to all privileges. On the squares of liberated villages, lively new dances replaced the old laments. Couples formed in public. Land, work, and bread were shared. The elderly received retirement benefits, and people took time to enjoy life. New practices were invented, and solidarity was renewed. Anarchism deployed its thinking to the extreme. Farmers' assemblies, literacy campaigns. Over 800 Spanish towns and villages declared themselves communes. And one of the greatest collectivist experiments in history had begun.
Dans la pratique,
there was an explosion of experiments.
Une explosion d'expériences.
Whole towns, not just villages, did away with money. Great. But how would they live? So they invented something that wasn't in the writings of theoreticians. The so-called familial salary, where everybody worked together. But how do you share things? Based on individual effort? No, based on individual needs.
They abolished money. It seems unbelievable today, but thousands of people adhered to it and organized themselves around it. Naturally, on these liberated lands, the clergy was expropriated, and the former landowners found themselves working hand in hand with the peasants.
Things didn't go smoothly everywhere. The anarchists chased out the Guardia Civil and the fascists. But then Franco's troops reconquered the villages, and you can imagine the repression that came after.
People mentioned the churches burned down and the priests killed by the anarchists. It is true. It did happen. When power is seized by the people, it generates acts like that. Revolutionary anarchist Mikhail Bakunin himself said, when revolution comes, it's inevitable that 100 heads will roll. 100 heads isn't a lot compared to the horrors committed by the fascists.
With almost unlimited material sent by Henry Ford and the support of Italian troops and the infamous German Konterlegion, Franco and his followers launched a campaign of social and ideological cleansing. Like in Seville, where 8,000 people were bayoneted to death. Or at Guernica, where men, women, and children were indiscriminately slaughtered by Luftwaffe bombs. Despite widespread fears, the request for arms made by the libertarians to Western democracies went unanswered. The anarchists could, however, count on the international solidarity of the movement, which, in newspapers and conferences, appealed for supporters to join the ranks of the insurgents. The Frenchman, Sébastien Faure, anarchist burglar, Maurice Jacob, the Algerian, Mohamed Say, the Argentinian, Diego Abad de Santillan, the Belgian, Louis Mercier Vega, the Russian, Georges Sassenko, and political activist, Simone Veil, who enrolled in the Daruti column, like Emma Goldman, who at 67 years old, fought in Catalonia. From all around the world, men and women arrived in Spain to support the revolution. And with the first international brigades, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, made up of mostly IWW members, the Malatesta Battalion, nicknamed the Battalion of Death, and the Louise Michel Battalion from France, foreign revolutionaries, as they arrived, suddenly brought about a change.
In their countries of origins, whether they were French, British, American, or Italians or Germans who were in Franco's camps, at no time had they ever encountered an anarchist movement on such a huge scale. George Orwell wrote a wonderful account. In Britain, he frequented not a communist milieu, but a Trotskyite milieu, and he came to Spain to fight. When he arrived in Barcelona, It was a big discovery for him. In Britain, he had no idea that the anarchists existed and even held the city. His account has a slightly odd title, Homage to Catalonia.
In theory, it was perfect equality, and even in practice, it was not far from it. There is a sense in which it would be true to say that one was experiencing a foretaste of socialism, by which I mean that the prevailing mental atmosphere was that of socialism. Many of the normal motives of civilized life had simply ceased to exist. The ordinary class division of society had almost disappeared. There was no one there except the peasants and ourselves, and no one owned anyone else as his master.
As the international brigades left to reinforce the anarchist columns in the front, to the rear, now aware of the key role the propaganda could play, the libertarians took over the film industry and, with the little money they had, shot newsreels of the fierce battles they were fighting in Aragon. But in this war of images, in which for the first time it was they who were doing the filming, the anarchists made sure to report on the scale and specifics of their revolution as CNT cameramen captured live footage of an insurgent capital.
The first report on events in Barcelona was made by the CNT, the Union of Public Spectacle. They went out onto the streets to film what was happening at the barricades. We have some marvelous footage of a city in revolution. We don't have any of St. Petersburg or other places, but here we have footage that tells what a city in revolution is like.
These images show a city that is practically anarchist, with an incredible popular enthusiasm that has never been reproduced in our history.
These newsreels revealed to the world the scale and coherency of the Spanish libertarian revolution. Amidst the remains of the barricades and the destroyed centers of power, documentary makers such as Felix Marquet captured each step in this great upheaval. Here, anarcho-syndicalism was working at full steam. All forms of bureaucracy, non-productive jobs, and the role of foreman were abolished. Major decisions were taken in councils. Work was carried out in common, and production means recuperated by the collectivity. In Catalonia, far from the industrial heart of Spain, over 75% of companies were self-managed. Tramways, taxis and buses, hotels and restaurants, bakeries, fishing, foodstuffs, textiles, the leather and shoemaking industry. All these small businesses, like large companies, were now managed collectively with no fall in efficiency or production. The revolution even made inroads into culture, which suddenly became popular and social once more. Movies, classical music, opera, and cabaret were managed directly by the actors, dancers, musicians, technicians, and ushers, who were all members of the CNT. Emma Goldman, who was 67 when she arrived in Catalonia to support the revolution, wrote,
"The collectivization of the industries and the land stand out as the greatest achievement of any revolutionary period. Your revolution will destroy forever the idea that the anarchist project means chaos. Moreover, if Franco should win and the Spanish anarchists be exterminated, the work they have started will continue to live."
An excerpt from No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism by Tancred Ramonet. Yours for a $180 pledge to KPFA. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. I have to say I haven't left myself much time to raise money. But I want to thank all of you who've called so far. We did make the match. Marco Jimenez in Oakland, thank you so much for your pledge. Joe Ryan in Forest Ranch, thank you so much. Lydia Blanchard in Santa Cruz, I want to thank you. Marilyn Byrne in Redlands, thank you so much. Joey in Merced, thank you very much. And Lawrence Canalog, I hope I'm saying that right, in Valley Village. They all called 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-KPFA. And of course, you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. And the hour is running out, and I have been handed yet another match by three listeners, one Karen in San Francisco, David in Oakland, Colleen in Novato, collectively put up $600 saying they will match you dollar for dollar if you pledge by now to the top of the hour. Well, that is less than 7 minutes to make quite a bit of money. So I'm hoping you'll have felt moved by what you've heard and will pledge accordingly and call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or go to kpfa.org and pick up This three-hour, three-documentary film series is a box set. It includes an interview with America's most famous anarchist, Noam Chomsky, also a booklet of essays, yours for a $180 pledge or more to KPFA. And, you know, there are tremendous resonances with the present because, of course, anarchism arose in a period of inequality, of social strife, of people feeling sort of thrown under the wheel. And the words, the war on terror, were actually first applied to anarchists in the late 19th century. That is where that term comes from in the United States. This is history I think we should all know. It is so interesting, fascinating, and I can't do justice to it, the history of the Spanish Revolution in 1936 and how, as they say in the documentary, and you can see if you actually watch it, there's tremendous newsreel footage of the anarchism in Catalonia, in Barcelona, in this revolutionary city that all of a sudden reorganizes itself along anarchist lines. It is an amazing story, and it's so important because we get the message over and over that there are no alternatives to capitalism and to the way our society is structured, and that any other possibility will end with a gulag. Well, that's certainly not true. And this story is an amazing one. It's an inspiring one, and it's an important one to know, and I'd say even reclaim as part of our collective history. 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. $600 is on the line right now, so whatever you pledge, your money goes a bit further for us, and we certainly need it right now. Your dollars are doubled by Karen, David, and Colleen. So I'm really hoping that you will call us and support this institution that is often maybe not remembered enough, that it was founded by anarcho-syndicalists who were indeed conscientious objectors and came out of internment camps. But they were people committed to the ideas of anarchism. And there's a whole story to be told about how the era of classical anarchism ended in mid-century, how people kept the anarchist torch burning, including people like Lewis Hill and Eleanor McKinney, who started KPFA. And that tradition is alive and well in this institution, and you'll be supporting that the collectivity that KPFA entails, because, of course, the people who started KPFA, they understood that for it to work, people would have to give money for something they actually got for free. And they believe that they would. And so I'm hoping you also believe the same and will pledge right now. 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA, kpfa.org. And your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. This is a fantastic film. It covers, or film series, I should say. It covers three large swaths of history from 1840 to 1906, 1907 to 1921, and then 1922 to 1945. So touching on the uprisings in Europe in the late 19th century, the Mexican Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the conviction of and execution of Italian-American anarchist Sacco and Vanzetti, the rise of fascism, and then revolution in Spain. And, of course, we're facing a period now where we do see the rise of the far right. We have increased social strife, certainly a social inequality of a kind that hasn't been seen in about a century. And it's a time that is really ripe for thinking about another world and to have a sense of all of the traditions of the left and all of the traditions within those traditions, the radical traditions, that anarchism is probably, if you look at this film, if you view it, you will realize that it is comprised of all sorts of different complex ideas that are not at all the stereotyped bomb-throwing, it's all about chaos notion that is the kind of simplistic version that we get of anarchism today in the media and elsewhere. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. We are $360 towards our goal of $600 before the hour is up. And before the hour is up, that's a minute and just over a minute and a half. So I'm hoping that three of you will go to your phones right now and be the ones who put us over the top. KPFA needs your money now more than ever. This really is our time of need. And if you think we're really an important institution, that we are part of these larger radical struggles and that our future is connected to the future of those radical struggles, then I really urge you to call right now, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org. Your dollars are doubled right now, but it's a conditional pledge that these three listeners, Karen, David, and Colleen, have put up, that they will contribute the equivalent $600 if you will help us make that amount, the equivalent amount, by the end of the hour.